Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome. Boy, Jolene Jordan and I. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter. Hello.
We missed last week.
We did.
We don't like to take Sundays off.
We don't, but we were made to take it off.
Yes.
Yeah. Not because we're in trouble.
Well, this is a hell of a job, though, when you don't want the night off.
I know. Well, when you're on once a week and there's so much going on in the world and so much to rave on about.
Well, I remember we used to do it five and did I? I'm trying to remember. Did we? Yeah, I think we did like it when we got a day off and we were doing 5 days a week, week in and week out. Hey, this is a talk program in the sense that usually you only think of right-wingers do it. You know, all those guys that you hear just filled with meanness and lies and all that. This is sort of on the other side of things, though, if you're just joining us for the first time. I'm Peter Werby. With me is Jolene Jordan. 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. I shouldn't say and. That's what the WRIF is. My website, peterwerby.com, if you'd like to email us, if the phones are busy, or if you're shy, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, short messages, please. And MySpace, we have a page, myspace.com, Night Call, Detroit. Have you still been managing that? I haven't looked at it.
I have, every day.
Really?
Yeah, I was on there several times today.
Good.
Yeah.
We got lots of friends?
We're still getting friends, yeah. Yeah, I don't know the exact number, but we're doing well.
Boy, I didn't realize till a week ago Friday that we were going to have last Sunday off. So I prepared all these stories that to comment on, and then I ran into our program director, Doug Podell, who also does middays here at WRIF in Detroit. And he said, hey, you know, you guys have the holiday off as usual. So I thought, you know, this... Here it all is, you know. And, of course, just another week filled with horror stories and abuses. And by the way, you know, folks, someone told me once, he said, you must be a pretty unhappy, grim person to say that.
Really?
What we have to look at, I think, particularly people that are privileged, and many of us, not all of us, but many of us who live in the United States and in North America and Western Europe, are privileged compared to the rest of the world. If you're white, you tend to be more privileged. If you're middle class, even more. If you're a male, even more. So, you know, I've got a lot going for me just by the virtue of all those things. So when I could probably, and many of you could, just ignore all this stuff. Ignore wars, ignore the economy, the economy that's happening good for the people that have all the investments. They're doing great. Another record. And of course, it's just going to go up and up and up and up. It's never going to go down, right? Ooh. And so what I'm looking at out of a fairly privileged life, or maybe even take away the modifier and say a privileged life, to look at what's wrong with this joint. I mean, our city, our state, our nation, this world, and try to make that a little closer to the privileges that I have. Because there's nothing that I have for it. And can I include you in that?
Yes.
You know, you're not a male.
Well, no, I recognize the privilege. I never really did before someone brought it to my attention that I'm a privileged person. I'm like, what do you mean? I've done, you know, I had this kind of strange Republican mindset, and I think it's because I was raised by Republicans, you know? And someone called me out once a few years ago, and I said, I'm not privileged. What do you mean? Just because I'm white? Blah, blah. Well, I am, and I recognize it, so.
Well, I was thinking about, there's so many things to talk about. It's just absolutely amazing. There was, I don't know, I'm not particular. You can, listen, folks, you can bring up anything you like and do so by calling 313-298-WRIF. The Democratic, never mind, I said something funny that only me and Al, our phone screener, Al Slayer, will think is funny.
Okay.
But forget about it. There was the Democratic presidential candidate debate today tonight in New Hampshire.
I watched a portion of those, and this is the greatest part about the whole thing, Peter. I fell asleep.
Well, I don't have a lot of interest in it, although from what I read, as usual, Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Cleveland, and Mike Gravel, who was the senator from Alaska, told the truth and said what was really happening and don't have handlers and don't have consultants and aren't putting their finger in the wind. But, you know, I was looking at these guys. Even physically, they look all like fairly decent people. You know, those Republicans are a pack of screwball. They're nuts.
They're frightening to look at that group all together in one room. But, Kucinich was great. He was, Peter.
Well, I was thinking of some of the stories, and I was thinking that each one of them had a name attached to it. Cindy Sheehan, Jack Kevorkian, our own, Dr. Jack, Dr. Death. I actually have a little brick from Dr. Death's apartment that they knocked down. He lived on Royal Oak, right on Main Street.
Yeah. Now he's moving to Bloomfield Hills.
But he gets out of jail after 8 years. You know, everybody knows Dr. Death, Jack Kevorkian, right? The guy that admitted to ending 130 lives, mercy killings.
Suicide.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, one of the most convincing things he ever said in his defense was that every crime has a victim, right? I mean, if it's a crime, it should be a victim. Like, in other words, if you're gambling, the problem is gambling, but it's somebody who's willing to take part in and what have you. Same thing. If you had asked any murder victim if you could bring them back to life and say, did you object to being killed by the perpetrator of your death? They would say, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. The people that wanted to die at the hands of Jack Kevorkian wanted to end their lives.
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did. So,
I dedicated a song to him the other night. I did a rock and roll air shift.
Nice.
I can't even remember what it was. I was delirious, and it was on CNN over and over, so I finally decided we'd just send him out of tune.
Have you ever seen his art? He's also an artist.
No.
Yeah. Weird stuff, I can tell you.
Really?
Yeah. All right, so in the news, Cindy Sheehan, Jack Kevorkian, Al Sharpton, who's in our fair city, Detroit, has a coalition that's going to clean up the lyrics of rap music. Michael Moore, that's still going on about his... I'm really looking forward to seeing that sicko.
I am too.
But this is all sort of... Well, you know, one of the things that was said about Cindy Sheehan, this incredibly... forthright and articulate and honest and a mother who suffered a grievous loss of a son in the war in Iraq, a spokesperson for the anti-war movement, in a lot of ways has resigned. And some of the people were accusing her of being an attention whore. Wasn't that what the phrase
was? That was part of it, yeah. She got a really bad rap, and the right just attacked her over and over.
But
they hate her.
Who projected her? It's always the media. And I'm not saying she didn't deserve it, or I'm not glad. I'm glad that Cindy Sheehan is projected. I'm glad that Michael Moore is projected.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Kevorkian and Al Sharpton, I don't know. What? But actually, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerbe.com. You'll see a picture of me and Cindy Sheehan that a friend of mine took of us while we were in Caracas, Venezuela. What was it, a year ago, January? And I was going to put a couple of attention whores. And it certainly is out of my part if I'm putting that on my site, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I would like to meet her.
Yeah, she's a, you know, I said, you know, Cindy, I've never done this with anybody. Can I take my picture with you? And she just said nicely, she said, sure.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I don't think she set out to be the leader of anything.
No.
I think she was just trying to make a point and set up Camp Casey in Texas,
yeah.
Which now she's selling the land.
Yeah.
Did you read about that?
She did. In fact, this right-wing pro-war group, you believe there's still pro-war groups?
Yes,
yeah.
I guess.
What's this group called? Move America Forward. Group. Everybody, including Bushko, all the war criminals in the among them are strategizing how to get us out of there. And yet these Nimrods are still, yes, you know, we support this war. Well, actually, I want to go in the absolute opposite direction, because probably one of the most important things that was unreported this week was, in fact, unreported. But this could be, this could be a turning point in American history. I sure hope that I am incorrect. If fascism comes to a country, you usually don't get a little card in the mail that says, by the way, all the constitutional guarantees of your country are going to be eradicated. Just the fascist strike, like they did in Chile. Of course, they were aided by the United States, by Nixon and Kissinger, back in 1973, September 11th, interestingly. Or in a lot of the European countries as well. The fascists, whether they were Nazis or fascists in Spain and Italy, just struck. Now, this is from the Progressive magazine. This another one of these magazines on the left that goes back, at least 75 years or what have you. And you can go to progressive.org. The headline they've put on it, Bush anoints himself as the insurer of constitutional government in emergency. Now, I've read this.
Try to wrap your head around that.
Yeah, I mean, I had a number of people said, what? What did you just say? Bush anoints himself as the insurer of constitutional government in emergency. And here's what it says. With scarcely a mention in the mainstream media, that's the MSM, President Bush has ordered up a plan for responding to a catastrophic attack. And there's been plans right along. Clinton had one. Under that plan, he, George W. Bush, entrusts himself, George W. Bush, with leading the entire federal government, not just the executive branch. And he gives himself the responsibility, quote, for ensuring constitutional government. He laid this all out in a document entitled National Security Presidential Directive, NSPD 51, and Homeland Security Presidential Directive, HSPD 20. Now, there could be, who knows, anything from terrible results of global warming to another catastrophic attack on our soil, and particularly given the policies of George W. Bush engendering those kind of attacks. But you would think that this would be something that would ensure that the institutions that make this a democracy, that is a balance of powers and the continuation of all the aspects of government, would continue as well. It defines a catastrophic emergency in this document as, quote, any incident, regardless of location, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage, or disruption severely affecting the U.S. population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government function, close quote. Now, given this, on September 11th, Bush could have declared himself the let me get into this a little more, and it makes a little more sense. Oh, yeah, it says here, next line. Pardon me. This could mean another 9/11 or another Katrina or a major earthquake in California, since it says it would include localized acts of nature, accidents, and technological or attack-related emergencies. The document emphasizes the need to ensure, quote, the continuing function of our form of government under the Constitution. But it says the president shall lead the activities of the federal government for ensuring constitutional government. And so here is a man who has completely erased the balance of power and signs a unilateral executive directive appointing himself El Duce, essentially, the leader, if there is any kind of, catastrophe, human-made, I should say man-made, because most of these, you know, I've never heard of a woman-made catastrophe, right?
There isn't one.
No. But this is extraordinarily frightening.
He always wanted to be the dictator. Remember he said that?
Yeah. Now, George Bush, on four separate occasions, and I used to have this at hand, but go, if you want to go, as he says, go to the Google, and you can put in George Bush, favorite form government, and see what comes up. So on three or four, it may have been four, but I hate to exaggerate. Three different times, and this was in his first term. He hasn't said this in a long time because I don't think he's joking anymore. That he said, my favorite form of government is a dictatorship as long as I'm the dictator.
Ha ha. Oh, you're so funny. Yeah. Too bad you meant it.
Yeah. Now, what is happening with GW? Here is a man extraordinarily unpopular, only sort of it's below the fascist third that would support anybody like him. It's down to like 28%. And old George is, I guess it's young George, isn't it? Old George is probably just at home saying, what happened?
No, he's crying over one of those. Did you see
this
that?
This is Herbert Walker?
Yeah, he recently spoke at, what is that? Not Pat Robertson, not Jerry Falwell, but the other one.
Some other right-winger died?
Right. I don't know if he died or he was speaking at one of these churches and he cried at how great this guy was for America. Yeah, this is recently. He keeps crying. I think he's having a mental breakdown because of his kid.
Georgie Ann Geyer, who is a columnist for the Dallas News. Dallas is in the state of Texas, right? Georgie Ann Geyer in a column called A Spreading Terror, talking about terrorism and how terrorism is beginning to leach out of Iraq into other countries, particularly with this enormous refugee problem. But here's a quote from this column. Friends of Bush's from Texas were shocked recently to find him nearly wild-eyed, thumping himself on the chest three times while repeating, I am the president! I am the president! I am the president!
Really?
He also made it clear he was setting Iraq up so his successor could not get out of, quote, our country's destiny. This is an extraordinarily frightening man.
Oh.
Yeah, remember he was calling himself, I am the commander man. Too.
Yeah.
And he had a number of times has said that he is the commander-in-chief. He is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He is not the commander-in-chief of the nation.
In fact, doesn't he work for us? I think that's how
I don't think he thinks so.
No.
Remember that in Fahrenheit 9/11 where he said that he looked at all these rich people and he said, you are my base.
Oh, yeah. That was frightening.
Yeah. He let it be known. Now, JFK, I thought they kept saying JFK plot. I thought they were talking about, the assassination.
Oh, right.
But no, they're talking about these four men accused of a plot to blow up Kennedy Airport terminals and fuel lines. Well, on one level, it sounds like are these guys, like the guys who are going to blow up the Sears Tower in Florida, like, they were a joke that they never could have pulled it off. And a lot of the things... I actually saw that on the news. They had all these grim-faced FBI agents and Homeland Security, and you thought they had just... It looked like something, post 9/11 or, right after that. And, of course, they were nowhere near... they didn't have any of the wherewithal for bombs and what have you, but they could very well have gone along their merry way.
A plan.
Yeah, a plan, and then you carried out. Of course, they had an FBI informer among them that was urging them along.
Oh.
But regardless, the Bush policies have among many young Muslim men, I don't even know many, probably say it's 1%. Well, how many folks are Muslims? Like 2 billion or 1 billion or something like that. I don't know. What's 1% of 1 billion? Like a million or something like that, right?
Yeah, do the math on that.
Yeah, do the math on that one. What if it's 1/10 of 1%? That still turns out to be hundreds of thousands of people that just seethe with anger when they see the United States threatening Iran, when they see the United States shipping emergency aid, military supplies to Lebanon so the Lebanese army can attack Palestinian camps, what's going on right now. And the ongoing war in Iraq, the ongoing war in Afghanistan, it's almost like this is guaranteed to create a catastrophic incident of the type that would allow George W. Bush to emerge as the insurer of the Constitution. And that sounds just like a dictator. Now, I guess do we all know this? Maybe we don't. 1932 in Germany, there was the last free election. Hitler's party got about a third, the fascist third. In all the turmoil that was going on in this republic called the Weimar Republic, he was only able to garner one-third of the electoral the votes. The left, by the way, the combination of communists and socialists got over 50%, but they were squabbling, so you know they couldn't pull it together. Then that Bush was... that was a Freudian sleep.
That sure was.
Yeah.
I wish everyone could have seen your face.
Hitler was then appointed chancellor and then began limiting the ability of the left parties to function. And then what happened? There was a fire in the parliament, the so-called Reichstag. And then Hitler declared an emergency, and all the rest is the horrors that we know. I've never really been a fan of that, of people that see that as the trajectory.
The comparison,
or that as the trajectory of the Bush administration. But more and more, I'm seeing that, who knows? Who knows where this is all going to lead us? Because this goes back to saying, you do not get a postcard in the mail saying there's going to be fascism the next time there's a terror attack, and with all the anger that Bush has created towards us, with the creation of thousands and thousands and thousands more terrorists, people committed to committing acts of terror against the United States that have been trained, and I don't mean trained by Al-Qaeda, but trained by their experience as insurgents against the United States invasion and occupation. So this doesn't make sense to us, but if it ensures the power of this right-wing cabal, these people who are both insane and incompetent and see only power and money as the basis for their political rule, we're in a world of trouble. And as I say on my website, patriots, be ready to resist. You know, I actually talked to a colleague of ours here, someone I was telling you about earlier. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. And she said, and hopefully this would be true, the American people would never stand for this. She said, I would be in the streets. And
for what Bush did, the power?
If all of a sudden Bush declared himself the insurer of the Constitution and suspended civil liberties and civil rights and began ruling.
I don't know. There's a lot of people who are just the sheeple, will go along with whatever he says, you know. And I still can't believe anyone still thinks this guy is doing anything good for our country.
Well let's say there's a 28%. Would people get fooled again? You know, even some of you people that were even born when the Who sang that song. I mean, how many more times will you be fooled? And certainly people that are older, I mean, don't keep getting fooled time after time after time by these right-wing liars, okay? And if you're old enough to listen to this program, you're undoubtedly, I don't know. Actually, there's people that are 13 years old. So think, when the Iraq war started, they were like 9. But we know now, Bush lied completely, that all of this was just fabricated. So the next time they say, we have to do this extraordinary event or take this extraordinary step, don't fall for it. Or at a minimum, assume, as I've said, about reading the news and listening to people on the media, including me and Jolene, assume that it ain't true. Okay? Everything I've said, if you said, you know, I don't necessarily believe everything you said, I'd say that's very cool. But some of you will kind of connect dots like we connect the dots, and it'll make a lot of sense.
Right.
But if you said, you know, I'm not going to take that, what you said, at face value. I got to look at some of this stuff. I got to check your sources. I've got to think about this.
Please do.
But when people who stock and trade, politicians, tell you something, you can assume they're lying with some sense of that you're going to turn out to be correct. All right, just one other. It's a horrible event. I've mentioned this before. Again, this is no big story. Russia tested a new rocket that will beat missile defenses. The United States is bringing nuclear war to the doorstep of Russia. They're setting up these anti-missile sites in... I actually don't even have this here. I can't remember what the countries were. Do you... The Czech Republic and Poland, right. A new base in Bulgaria, another one in Romania, a missile defense site in Poland, and a radar site in the Czech Republic. And the Russian said, what are we supposed to do? We can't just sit back and look at that.
Yeah.
So why is the United States putting up these all these bases circling the Soviet Union like this is 1955 or something like that? Like, yeah, what I always say, what year is this?
Yeah.
Well, you know why this is being put there in the Czech Republic? It's put there because of the fear of rogue nations, Iran and North Korea, because you never could tell. Iran might decide to nuke the Czech Republic. That makes a lot of sense, right? Or maybe North Korea will try a strike on Bulgaria. Well, they might. Well, actually, they wouldn't. They don't have the capacity, won't have the capacity. This is on one hand, a boondoggle in the sense that we're going to be spending hundreds of billions of dollars of our money. Think about Michigan. Think about our budget and how close to bankruptcy the state is and the inability to meet its bills and what have you. And think about Bush spending our billions, our tax dollars that could be going for our roads and schools and first responders and everything else that we need here. And instead is turning it over to the war industries and turning it over to these countries to say, oh, yeah, you want to spend a few, hundreds of millions in our country? Sure, come on over. What the hell?
Yeah. It's as if he wants to make it as bad as he possibly can before he leaves.
Well, yeah.
I think he knows the Republicans aren't going to win this next election, in my opinion.
But that could very well be. First Deputy Prime Minister of Russia, Sergei Ivanov, speaking separately, said the deployment of medium and short-range missiles by Russia's neighbors to the east and south now pose a real threat. And he says, of course, this is prohibited by these treaties, which George Bush, which he doesn't believe in international law, he doesn't believe in the laws of the United States, he's broken them repeatedly, he has committed high crimes and misdemeanors for which he should be impeached. But he says, Ivanov says, in these conditions, it is necessary to provide our troops with modern, high-precision weapons. So we are in an arms race like this was 50 years ago. I mean, these people, Bushko, this, I don't know, never mind, you don't need all that. But now, Ivanov, let me see, Ivanov, a former defense minister and leading hawk. In other words, he is very, according to, I don't know if this is belligerent or if it's just realistically, is widely seen as a front-runner to succeed President Vladimir Putin in an election next March, although he's not said whether he will run. So that's what Bush is setting up, a nuclear arms race which with a country that is armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, that was willing to disarm, but was turned down by Bush like 5 years ago, and it's come to this. These people in Washington threaten our existence. I mean, sure, they threaten our economy, they threaten our civil rights, but they threaten our very existence. They are dangerous. They have to be, and
you know, it almost makes me want to get one of these emergency kits and put it in my basement, and I have been resisting this all along. I said, I'm not going to do that. Nothing's going to happen on my, you know, here in Detroit, but I don't know. I think I'm going to prepare for the worst.
Well, I don't know. They have these little, there's going to be like a nuclear attack on the United States. They have this thing is put your left hand. Put your left hand on the wall or something like that. Pick up your right foot, turn your head to the rear and kiss your ass
goodbye.
Yeah. Let's see. There was an impeachment town hall discussion last Tuesday that I went to. It was incredible. As you may or may not know, that the city council of the city of Detroit passed a resolution calling for the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. It was introduced by Joanne Watson, who's on the Detroit City Council, and also Martha Reeves, testing your rock and roll history. Martha Reeves, Dancing in the Street.
Right?
Martha and the Vandellas, who's on the city council, also on the board of my local, of American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. Bill Goodman from the National Lawyers Guild, Marion Kramer from the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, Colonel Ann Wright, who spent almost 30 years in the military, Ray McGovern, who was a policy analyst for the CIA. And whenever you think it's bad, all you got to do is listen to these people and you go, man,
It's worse than I thought.
Well,
good for the city council.
All right, let's do this. I was going to take some calls, but let's do our break, and we'll be right back. If you're on hold, please stay there. Al Slayer will get you called, and we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby with Jalene Jordan.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF.com.
Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. Our phone number is here in Detroit, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Email calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we were talking about the fact that Bush has declared himself the insurer of the Constitution. Extraordinarily frightening development, that he has signed an executive order naming himself in the case of catastrophic attack. And it doesn't have to mean like the whole country's wiped out. It would mean 9/11, Katrina, something like that. And it seems to me that given the fact that let's assume that a lot of that, at least some of these plots that have been uncovered, could have led to real attacks inside the United States. And these are people aren't connected with Al Qaeda. They're just watching the television and seeing what is happening around the world, what Bush is doing around the world, and figuring they're going to strike back at us here. I mean, they're figuring, hey, if we've killed 650,000, and they don't say Bush, they don't say our troops, they say us. If we've killed 650,000 Iraqis, if we've set 4 million of them into refugee status, if we're fighting in Afghanistan, if we're sending warships to Iran, if the body count is multiplying, they want to take it out on us. To them, if it's a war, okay. We're attacking their territory. They're going to attack our territory. That's their logic. I don't accept it in the slightest, because attacks on civilians are never warranted. Everybody has an excuse why they kill civilians. You know, it's for communism. It's for capitalism. It's for you know, whatever. Everybody's got a little excuse why women and kids, non-combatants, elderly people wind up dead. But I don't tell you the truth. I don't buy a single one of them. So, yeah, we got callers, don't we, Jillian? Maybe we should.
Yeah, we're almost full up there.
Get some. Well, nobody. All right. Well, here's somebody who wants to talk about Bush. Let's see what Ron in Detroit wants to say. Ron, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Well, I'd like to suggest that your analysis of what's going on with the missiles surrounding Russia is defective. Yeah, money might be involved, but it's purely a minor issue. If you went to globalresearch.ca, which is Michelle Chosadovsky's excellent website.
Yeah, I know him.
There would be no doubt what is going on. The Russians correctly perceive that these missiles are there as a counter. They are there to prevent the Russians from responding to a first strike. The United States has never given up the idea that it is going one way or another is going to take Russia. And the Russians know it. They were quite naive, I guess, at the beginning, because they thought that once the Soviet Union went, that would be all that it that would matter. But the fact is, the U.S. is the Fourth Reich. We are an empire, and Americans have got to wake up to the fact that the empire is the cause of much of what is wrong with this country.
Well, certainly that is the truth. I mean, empire has disastrous consequences for everywhere it touches, both at home and abroad. But the idea that that the United States under George Bush or whoever wants to actually extend rule into the territory of Russia, I don't think so whatsoever.
Is he saying that Chosudovsky said this?
Yeah. Well,
Peter, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, well, I think you're wrong about that.
And wait. What am I? I don't understand what I'm wrong about.
Because, in fact, first of all, they want that oil, they want that gas, and they want those natural resources.
Yeah, but they can't get it by military means. That's insane.
I disagree with you. Look what they did to the Soviet Union. They are very confident with the new technologies that are coming on board that they will have such superior such superior armed forces that if they don't, they won't even have to resort to maybe military action. They will simply cause the Russians to cave in.
Well, in the same way that they caused by the whole arms race, they caused even more economic dislocation in the Soviet Union that would have than was occurring anyway.
That's a feature. And then after Russia, remember, on to China. Never forget that the ultimate goal is to bust up China into little pieces. They're already fomenting action there, just like they are inside at the border hinterlands around Russia, fomenting little agitation, little groups to rebel, very similar to what they're doing right in Iran right now, right today.
I don't think they're doing much in China. It's interesting, though, while China was ostensibly, I guess it still is, but really defined itself in very heavy terms as a communist nation, it was no threat to the United States whatsoever. Once it became essentially a capitalist nation, albeit a primarily a state capitalist, but also private entrepreneurial capital there as well, suddenly it's an enormous threat to the United States. Maybe they should have left it as a communist country.
They always wanted China. The empire was never going to rest until, in fact, it controls the entire world. If people understand the insatiable appetite of the empire, the people who run this.
Yeah, I think that's exaggerated. Look, World War II in the Pacific in many ways was fought for control of China and the resources over there. I mean, Japan, what have you, that it was pretty clear that it was an inter-imperial war. I mean, the other side was pretty awful. There's no doubt about it. But the United States and Britain, Netherlands, France, all those countries controlled important pieces of Asia. And Japan wanted that for themselves. So they thought they would be able to exploit all the resources and the people and what have you. And the idea that there's any section of the American ruling class, that including these nuts, these neocons and Bush and Cheney, that want to physically, militarily control the whole world, I don't buy that. I mean, for one thing, that they can reap enough wealth simply by keeping the world on a knife's edge all the time in terms of military expenditure. So now we have almost completely military-industrial complex in terms of an economy that are producing things. Other than that, it's a service economy and one heavily based on debt. All right, Ron, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Hey, send me stuff. I can never say the guy's name. What is it?
Michelle Chosudovsky.
Chosudovsky, yeah.
Who we've interviewed a few times.
Yeah, I had you say his name.
Yes.
But, Ron, send me his column at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, thanks a lot. Let's continue on. Here is Marion in Dearborn. Marion, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene. When I heard you talking about George Bush signing that executive order, my blood ran absolutely cold. When did this happen?
Well, it would happen. It would be keyed by some catastrophic event.
No, he signed it last week.
When did it happen? It was...
he signed it the 4th of May, wasn't it?
Something right around
there. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know what I was thinking? I was thinking a while ago that because Republicans are so out of favor, like Jalene said, I'm afraid that they're going to stage something at or around the election to suspend the elections, and George Bush is going to be like dictator.
Well, remember we said that in 04, and that never happened. They cheated their way, essentially, to power once again to the presidency. I was trying to see here. Yeah, Bush quietly signed the new policy on May 4th. This is from the Boston Globe. The unclassified portion of his quote Homeland Security National Security Presidential Directive close quote, a special kind of executive order that can be kept secret, was also posted on the White House website on May 9th without any further announcement or press briefings.
They should have made banner headlines. Where are the Democrats? Where's the media?
With their thumb up their tushy. I don't know. Who knows? That's we can't count on those people.
No.
We can't count on those people at all. I mean, the American people spoke in November, and they're, there is some good work that's being done by these Democrats in the committees exposing the corruption, but they need to be more vigilant about what's going on and realize the threat to constitutional government that these people in the White House represent. Thank you, Marion. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Mike. Mike is calling from Canton. Hi, Mike. You're on WRIF. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I want to talk about education.
Sure.
Like the new curriculum standards that are going to be implemented in 2010 for the state of Michigan.
Okay.
What do you think about those and like what that's going to prepare students for?
You know, is that state standards or is that through the No Child Left Behind Act?
It's part of No Child Left Behind, but I think it's just a new state standard for Michigan. But I'm not sure what the rest of the country is doing. I'm not sure if they're following suit or if they're, you know, having their own curriculum standards different than ours.
Well, I hope you know more about this than I do, or we're not going to have much of a conversation. What's it all about?
Oh, well, I was just wondering because I'm a education major over at Eastern Michigan, and I'm a vocational and design technology education major, and those are pretty much jobs and classes that are, you know, being removed from schools, and now kids are being pushed to take more math and science and English and social study classes.
I thought we wanted that. I thought that things were going in the other direction.
Well, yeah, but I just read a book on this, and it's about like the global economy.
Yeah.
And they're like, that's what these new curriculum standards are kind of training our students to, you know, be a part of when they leave high school.
Hmm.
And you know, they want them to participate in a global economy. And what do you think that kind of, you know, what that's going to be for our future? You know, and how that, you know, affects us. And
well,
I guess.
Without a doubt, the entire economy is being integrated into one, you know, one economic entity. And I've always said we're going to wind up with one corporation called International General. And that the problem is, of course, is that we as workers wind up, whether we're middle class or, you know, doing industrial work, is we wind up in competition with people that are extraordinarily low paid, and that's what happens. When you have a free market of labor, there's so many people that, like potatoes, a lot of potatoes, the price goes down. So there's a lot of us's all around the world, and there's a lot of people in India and in China that are willing to work for awful wages and have no alternatives, just like here in the 19th century. Well, we formed unions in order to artificially raise the selling price of our labor. Because left to the market, we'd be screwed. And this is what the capitalists see as, you know, as the future. Is, you know, these trade agreements that erode labor standards and don't protect local economies. So I mean, it's one of the reasons, of course, you have the most ambitious of Mexican workers coming here. Their whole standard of living and their subsistence farming and, you know, corn production and all the culture around that has been dealt terrible blows because of NAFTA. And so that there's, I forgot what, like a million farms in Mexico have, people have lost their land and have wound up, the people with the least ambition wind up going to Mexico City or big metropolises like that, that are just awful places, or you know, good parts of them where the poor live. And the ones that are ambitious and want to provide for their families, they illegally enter this country. Hold on one second, let me grab something here. In the Detroit, I'm laughing again at a little joke between Al, our phone our phone screener, and myself. Today's Sunday Free Press, it says, leaders wonder if state ready to rethink unions. That means union labor is too expensive because of the competition from other states and the fact that, I don't know, take out public employees, the number of people in unions is so infinitesimal, and it's almost union wages are almost like a remnant, and the fact that union wages brought up non-union wages as well. Well, so now they're let me see. Michigan is bleeding jobs, especially good-paying top benefit manufacturing jobs. Supporters of making Michigan a right-to-work state, including about a dozen Republican legislators. Oh, what a surprise. Say a heavily unionized culture deters businesses from locating in the state. A couple things. The so-called right-to-work states are actually right-to-work-for-less states, and I think that even mentions this in here. In the all the right-to-work states, which are located in the South and the Plain States and in the West, on average, the industrial workers make $5,000 a year less than people in union states like Michigan and the Northeast and what have you. But what they're saying essentially, and this could be true, it could be true. I don't know if it is for sure. But let's give, these Republicans don't always lie, usually. But let's even give them the benefit of the doubt and say, yeah, that's right. That people are saying, well, gee, should I go to Alabama where I won't be facing a union? Or should I go to Michigan where I might be facing a union or at least an organizing campaign? What the hell? Let's go to Alabama. Or if I don't go to China or Mexico. And so what is this? This is capitalist blackmail. And this happens all the time. This is a race to the bottom in terms of wages and standards of living that says, hey, if you don't work for less and less and less, you're not going to have a job at all. So, and this was, what was the parts firm, the GM parts firm?
Delphi,
yeah. So these men and women are making $25 an hour, which turns out to be, for spending 40 hours a week in a factory for 30 years, doesn't seem to me to be, exaggerated pay at all. So then they're saying, well, maybe we're going to knock it down to about $8 or $9 an hour. Or you do want a job, don't you?
Mm.
So that's blackmail. That's essentially blackmail. Yeah. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Yes, I have to select on here. Here is Paul. Paul's in Brighton. Hi, Paul. Peter and Jolene, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're good.
Hey, still riding the bike?
Yeah, I'm still riding the bike.
Fight the power, man.
Yeah.
I figured things would get a bit more lenient, dealing the fact that Bush, he gave you no choice. When Gore and all those guys were going at it in the first place, he never even won the election.
Right.
But they gave you no choice with the fact that if you were to not vote for him, Gore and all the sympathizers would, I'm sorry to hear about all the kids that have accidents with guns, but they were going to have everybody register. So he either voted for Bush, and we lost our, I'd be really afraid right now if we'd have lost our rights to own a gun.
Wait, what are you talking about, Paul? No one.
Gore wasn't going to take away your guns.
There wasn't even an issue in the campaign.
The media and the right wingers made it an issue and made everyone who wants, the NRA folks made everyone run.
Yeah. They scared. So this, again, was.
Including
Was the big issue. Not the economy, not the war, they didn't have the war yet. So it comes down to this one issue that turned out to be a lie. Remember, if they're saying it, it's probably a lie. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate your call.
Hey, yeah, they're opening their mouth.
Yeah, right their mouths now. How do you know when they're lying? Their mouths are open. Right. Here's Kevin in Sterling Heights. Hey, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
So this, again, including you.
Hey.
Hello?
Turn off your radio, Kevin.
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment about Bush's new presidential order about him being ruler of the world.
Yeah.
I had heard, I don't know if this is true or not, but I think I got it from a pretty reliable source, that when George Bush Sr. was still president, he had went over there to the Middle East, and he had seen the way that the leaders kept their family in charge of the country, and he had loved the way that that worked out, and he had decided that he had wanted to do that for his children. Now, I guess, I'm really not surprised to hear about this.
That there's a dynasty, although some people have said it's going to be Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton, then who knows, Jeb, then what's the daughter's name? Clinton daughter, what's her name?
Chelsea.
Yeah. Who knows? It'll all be Clintons and Bushes.
I mean, I don't know about Clinton. I don't really think he did a bad job, just because he had himself his little scandal, I still think he did a pretty good job, There wasn't a deficit. I had a job with no problem when Bush was when Clinton was president, and then as soon as Bush became president, I started having problems keeping jobs and finding jobs. So.
Well, sure, he's tanked the economy.
Clinton was a good Republican and everything, but he was nothing compared to Bush.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Why am I having so much trouble selecting calls tonight? I don't know what's... All right, here's Lars in Madison Heights. Lars, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Julie.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to tell you about something I did a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I'm a former Marine. I went to my old high school and did anti-recruiting.
Wow. How does that work?
Did you do it Did you do it on your own, or were you...
Well, I've been out of the Marine Corps for almost a year now.
No, I know, but did you go over there by yourself, or were you invited?
Well, a teacher had invited me, and I brought some of my Marine Corps stuff to show kids, and then gave them a non-sugar-coated, objective story of my time in the Marine Corps.
Wow.
Let them try on the 30-pound flak jacket, you know, 4-pound helmet. I even brought in one of the older kind of flak jackets that a lot of troops were issued during the beginning of Operation Iraqi Freedom, the Don't Stop Rifle Bullets.
Remember that, Peter? Yeah. The and ones that didn't protect them.
Yeah, it's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Spells O-I-L. Yeah.
You know, the thing with what you hear about body armor problems now are people sending body armor to their relatives in Iraq. It's not because they have the old body armor. It's because the new body armor they issue is heavy and uncomfortable, but there's a new kind called dragon skin, which is used by Bush's security teams, like every other government organization that's like law enforcement that's tested as better than the interceptor vests that are current issue right now.
Hey, Lars, hold on. I actually have to do these spots right now. I'm going to put you... Oh, I almost blew you off here. Let me... Yeah, all right. I got you on hold. No, I don't. I got you on hold. No, I don't. All right. We'll get you on hold. We'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
Looking out there.
The pictures.
The podcast.
The blogs.
The special features you just can't get.
Anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I salute yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and I'm joined by Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello.
Welcome to our second hour. You can join us at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we have on the line Lars from Madison Heights, and he was telling us about counter-recruiting. That's a process where there's military recruiters and people, either peers, like students in high school or college, or in the case of Lars, a Marine vet, who goes there and say, hey, I want to give my side of things. It's not quite like the recruiters tell you. So welcome back, Lars.
Yes.
So basically, you're on the air again.
Okay. Oh, my mom had told me that one of my old teachers had called. She was asking if I would come to one of her classes and talk to her students about the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And she's kind of a liberal teacher. She didn't want me to sugarcoat it. So I came and I brought in, the heavy helmet, the heavy flak jackets they're issued. And I came and I just showed, had them try it on. They're all just aghast at how much the stuff weighed. And I told them I was wearing it at 130-degree temperatures.
I was going to say, right now it's about 100. And the official temperature in Baghdad is between 108 and 112.
Oh.
And then, plus, you've got a full uniform and full body armor. And aren't the packs oftentimes up near 100 pounds?
Yeah, you don't wear the pack that often. It's only during movements, and then you don't wear it for about an hour, take it off for 10 minutes, put it on, do another pumping for just walking at, 4 or 5 miles an hour for another hour, then take your gear off for another 10 minutes and drink water.
Well, you don't always get the best reception when you're doing that counter-recruiting. In fact, I was looking, I mentioned earlier, the Progressive magazine online. You go to progressive.org, and here is a case in, where is it? Stowe Monroe Falls Public Library in Ohio, near Kent State University. Vet prosecuted for opposing a recruitment in library. And what happened? There was this Gulf War vet who's 40 years old, and they noticed two military recruiters trying to enlist someone in a nearby room with a large glass window. And so the wife took out 3x5 cards and wrote messages to the man being recruited and put them up on the windowsill. One said, "Don't fall for it. Military recruiters lie." Another said, "It's not honorable to fight for a lying president." Well, one thing led to the next, and finally they called the cops on this couple that are putting up 3x5 cards, quite an offense, and they finally arrested the vet.
Wow.
But you got a better reception than that, huh?
I wasn't, just screaming anti-war. I just told them the truth, and a lot of them were shocked by, the fact that I was discharged early for service-related mental conditions, and the VA hasn't acknowledged my case yet. I have to get my medicines from the state.
Oh, that's really surprising.
Yeah, I'm sure probably the right-wingers are saying, he's a psycho, you know.
Yes, whenever the news media covers something, and it's some shocking revelation, and I just laugh. You're just finding us out now. It's are recruiters lying to cadets? Find out more at 7, or is it underage drinking? It may be going on as many as 3 of our nation's top military bases.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good for you, Lars. I mean, both sides always need to be heard, but this is not an opportune time for any young person to join the service. In fact, just sometimes how labor disputes can be won by workers withdrawing their labor. This would be a great time for the for Americans to say, we are not going to be involved in the United States military until this terrible war that is being, I said earlier, strategized at every level of this society. I mean, the people, all of us, we by our votes and by the polls, want us out of Iraq. And Bush and those guys, they're figuring out some scheme as well. And I mean, it may be that they're trying to figure out how can they win. No one believes that they can win in any conventional sense. But you've got a billion-dollar embassy there. That the desire was to control oil. That was the war is 95% about. And are they just going to throw in the towel? I don't know. I can't tell what these Looney Tunes are going to do. don't know. But thank you, Lars. Appreciate your call. And, well, I guess yours, I can't seem to click your line off. Can you try? Wait a minute. Here. I can do it here, I think. There you go. Bye, Lars. What's with this phone system? Hey, there's open lines. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. You know, I was thinking, I just sort of said that in passing about psychological evaluation, and I said, well, you know, these right-wingers are going to say, see, he's a psycho. This is the New York Times editorial today, or I guess now it was yesterday. What support our troops entails. Whenever and however American troops withdraw from Iraq, a flood of wounded and psychologically damaged veterans will present the nation for decades to come with costly needs that are already overwhelming government services. Now, this is what George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of these criminals have saddled these young people with, and to a large extent, the rest of us. I mean, it's nothing like. I mean, we're going to wind up paying for it. It's not like we've lost a limb. It's not like we've suffered severe head trauma. It's not like all the injuries that come with war. Now, get this. And Lars said he hadn't made any decision on his case. The backlog of disability claims stands at more than 405,000.
Well, there's your answer, Lars.
Yeah.
Gee whiz.
There's 405,000. There's been about a million men and women that have been through Iraq so far. Almost half of them, apparently, are filing disability claims. Cases averaging 177 days to be processed, almost twice the backlog for civilians. Experts estimate that an additional 400,000 claims will be filed in the next 2 years. So 800,000, can we say that's close to a million? This is the result of George Bush's lies. This is what we've done to 800,000 young men and women. And what's been done to Iraq and the hundreds of thousands of deaths there. And they figure that the death among U.S. soldiers, at least, the injury to death ratio is 8-1. So if there is now 3,500 almost American casualties, 14 more this weekend, or deaths, that you can multiply by 8 the number of injuries. Yeah. So that's
staggering.
I don't even do the math. 28, I don't know. What is it? 26,000 Americans grievously wounded as well.
And you know, the government can't even take care of those guys who came back from Vietnam at this point.
Yeah. They're still in the VA system.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Gulf War. And you know, they've never been willing to recognize the depleted uranium, depleted uranium problems, and all that stuff is still lurking around. It's all still lurking around.
I mean, how can they deny that? It's just unreal.
Let's go to Tom in Waterford. Tom, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. You asked a question earlier about what year you thought you were in.
Yeah.
How's 1984 sound?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Really.
I've been reading that book over and over again. The book itself is one of the scariest things I've ever read. And all I got to do is stand on my corner right here. I'm working at Tim Hortons here in Waterford, and I'm looking at how that is turning into our world right now. Slowly but surely, but it will have their way. They'll get to that point.
Tom, I must be a terrible person. You're talking about something extraordinarily serious like I urged you to. And all I'm thinking about, I wish I had a donut.
Well, you got to have a little spirit to go with
yeah.
it. But,
yeah.
No, with surveillance and the Christian fundamentalists trying to get into power and things like that, it's looking real ugly. But I was hoping you knew what book I was talking about.
Oh, 1984. You're right. It's interesting that George Orwell wrote that in 1948. As what they call a dystopian view of the future, but really it was he was talking about Stalinist Russia. But it has become so universalized. All that the 3 minutes hate, where this
where they rage.
Yeah, they rage and all the unending wars and all of that.
All the propaganda.
All of
the keep machine.
Big Brother.
Yeah.
Big Brother. You know, I always wondered why they called it Big Brother, whereas really, and this is particularly true for the right wingers, it's like a big father figure. That's really who I mean. Bush is your dad. It's kind of hard to imagine, but authoritarians really like these these big father figures. And certainly Stalin was the big father figure to the Russian people, because people always think that Soviet Union was such a horrible place, and it was. But there's lots of people in Russia that love Stalin. There's lots of people in Germany that loved Hitler.
Yeah. In Russia, I would believe, would be the closest thing that would come to that book, too. I was just getting out watching Declassified earlier on some website, and I was like, this looks really familiar.
Yeah. Well, no. In fact, there's a movie version of it, which isn't real good.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. There was a...
I watched it. I'm fascinated.
Is that Edmund O'Brien? Is that like the one from the 50s?
I watched the...
Well, they made a modern one. Actually, they made one like in the 80s, I think, or something like that.
Remember V for Vendetta?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the guy that played the totalitarian in that movie, he played Winston Smith in the 1984 movie.
Really?
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. Everybody... I like the message of that film, but... God, that movie, man, it was kind of silly in a lot of ways. They get with that guy with the mask the whole time. This woman is saying, "Well, I love you, V," and he's going, like you got this mask on. It was sort of a combination of, I said it one time, Zorro, who I can't remember now. I'll think about it as we go along. All right, thank you so much, Tom. Maybe we'll come get some donuts after we get off work. 313-298-WRIF, and I can see we got to go a new way to get the phones off. So we got some open lines as well for you. These right-wingers, it sounds disparaging for me to keep saying that these right-wingers are psychos, but they are a pack of psychos. Now, Dr. Laura, any of you listen, she's kind of this right-wing scold. She's always... When I've heard her from time to time, when a woman calls up and says, my living together partner or my companion, she said, "You mean you're shacking up with them?" That too is, what year is this?
But really, get with the current.
Yeah. And she's always talking about how religious she is and, talking about family values. She calls it Family Values Talk Radio. Her son.
I can't believe she still has a show.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty boring.
Schlesinger.
Yeah,
right?
Laura Schlesinger. Yeah. And the soldier son of talk radio, this is from the Salt Lake Tribune. The soldier son of talk radio, how about this, dear? My voice, man, I've never been bothered by allergies like I have this year.
Well, just walk around, you see all those things floating in the air. I can see why you are. The soldier son.
Can you see how I've marked it up?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes. The soldier son of talk radio relationship counselor, Dr. Laura, is under investigation for a graphic personal web page that one Army official has called repulsive. Well, the Army official's calling it repulsive. Okay. The site is credited to and includes many photographs of Derek Schlesinger, the 21-year-old son of the talk radio personality. What is he? Oh, here we go. It was a MySpace page, included cartoon depictions of rape, murder, torture, and child molestation.
This is Dr. Laura's son now, right?
Photographs of soldiers with guns in their mouths. A photograph of a bound and blindfolded detainee captioned, "My sweet little Habib."
Yeah, that's nice.
Repulsive. Accounts of illicit drug use. And a blog entry headlined by a series of obscenities and racial say it for me, please.
Epithets.
Thank you.
This is the son of Dr. Laura, and she was so proud of him because he put his, what do they say? He put his what where his mouth is? What's the phrase?
Put his...
something. Put his money.
Thank you.
Put his money.
Relisten
in other words, this guy enlisted, this young man at 20 years old, enlisted in the United States Armed Forces, off in Afghanistan. But read his quote. This quote is absolutely insane.
Yes?
Yeah, effing
yes. Yes, effing yes, said one blog entry on the Schlesinger site. "I love my job. It takes everything reckless and deviant and heathenistic and just overall bad about me and hyper-focuses these traits into my job of running around this horrid place doing nasty things to people that deserve it and some that don't."
That's really frightening. That's extraordinarily frightening.
Is he in Iraq?
No, he's in Afghanistan.
Oh, okay, yeah. It says, deployed earlier this year, his mother's talk show increasingly has been focused, oh, go figure, on the battles being waged in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. My wife has a pin that says, making enemies faster than we can kill them.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. That's a great pin.
All right, let's go back to our phones. Here's Mo. I don't see where you're calling. Where are you calling from, Mo?
Sterling Heights, Michigan.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, what's going on? I heard you guys are talking about some MySpace stuff and political stuff.
Yeah.
I just want to say for the record before I get cut off because my phone might die, F. Bush. F. Bush. Yeah. F. Capital F. Bush.
Well, amen, brother.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Is that it?
No, not really. I mean, I was calling just to BS with you guys.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we like to do that.
That's cool, right?
We do it well.
Yeah.
I'm not hurting the airtime, am I?
You're not hurting the airtime.
No.
No, no. Hey, when are you guys going to be coming out here for the muscle car shows?
Oh, yeah. We're out in Gresham.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a new Riff Muscle.
Yeah.
The Riff Muscle Car Club. I'm one of the members.
Very cool.
Oh, yeah.
Very cool.
I got the keychain and the bumper.
I think you should put a political sign on your muscle car.
A political sign on it?
Yeah. You know, like one in the window.
Yeah. I guess.
And I think it should say F. Bush.
F. Bush. Yeah, I'll do it. Hey.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll be up at one of the muscle car shows, and then I'll put it on there. You'll know who it is.
Tell him Peter sent you.
Yeah. I've got a muscle car.
I got a 1972 Mercury Cougar XR7.
Whoa.
The dumbest thing I ever did in my life, Mo, was I sold off a 1969 Ford Gran Torino convertible.
Why?
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 I know. I needed, you know how much I sold it for? $500.
Oh, what a shame.
I bought mine for $1,000, and it's about 80% of the way done. And it's a paint job and a little bit of bump work, and that's it.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
the one that I had a 390, scoop on the hood, bucket seats. They made, are you ready for this? This 69 Gran Torino Ford convertible, they made 5,500 of them only. I've never seen another one on the street again.
Maybe you sold it.
Yeah, yeah. What did I know then? Yeah, I know. Well, I'm sounding dumb. It's like when I was watching Patrick Swayze movies when I went on vacation. Thank you, Mo. We'll see you out there. All right. Here's Mark in Bloomfield. Mark, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing good.
I was just listening to what you're saying about family values and Dr. Laura, and I just think it's a shame that it's always the case with the people who are claiming to support family values. They're always the ones that end up being in trouble. And,
yeah, isn't it?
True.
You know,
remember Ted Haggard, Reverend Haggard. Yeah.
Or whether it's Mark Foley or even President Bush with his own daughters.
Yeah.
I mean, what, 25 years old, they don't even have a job.
I think one of them has a job at New York, yeah. But I'm sure that privilege got her that job. I don't know.
You know, it's the phrase, of course, that describes them all are self-righteous. Yeah, and they're such frauds. They're such hypocrites. You know, I wish I could understand the mentality. I mean, the liberals, for instance, and leftists don't make any claims. I mean, we claim to be tolerant, to want a world based on love, to have it in balance and environmentally and economically and what have you. But we don't go around saying it is only us who support family values. And if some liberal said, I'm gay and doing a little blow while I'm, you know, we'd go, wow, that's weird. Because
whatever floats your boat.
Yeah.
I don't understand how war became the way of the American people. Those who claim to be all loving of Christ and everything, you know, I don't know if you read, there was a report this week that came out that said that the United States is one of the countries that most supports war, and I don't understand it. Why I was watching Bush at the Rose Garden speech talking about how we need to focus more on the terrorists. We need to kill terrorists. You know, we're at war.
You know,
don't forget that.
There was just a poll. I forgot to mention it. There was a poll, And the majority of people wanted to get out of Iraq, and there were strategies, and some, I can't remember the figures, some people just, everybody wanted to get out. But, you know, some people said we got to do it in stages. Other people said just get everybody on a big plane and get out of there, which can't be done, by the way. I mean, we've really gotten ourselves there. And what are we going to do with this billion-dollar embassy if we get out? What are we going to do with these tanks drive them into Kuwait or something like that? But only 6% of the people said that Bush should apologize.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I'm right there saying that Bush lied to the American people. He has destroyed this nation of Iraq. He's responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of civilians. He has destroyed this culture. He has sent millions of people into refugee status. And the first and foremost thing that would protect, I'm not even, you know, who knows if it would stop people, is that he would have to say, I want to apologize on behalf of the United States for attacking your country with absolutely no reason whatsoever.
And he would never do it.
No, and what can we do? In fact, maybe you ought to ask the Iraqi people, what can we do to make this right after this error that has cost thousands of American lives and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives? So that would be a real good start.
You know, listen to the terrorists is kind of out there, I guess. But, you know, what are the terrorists saying? Why are they doing this? I mean, they'll lay it out right on the line why it's happening.
Yeah. Why are we spending billions of dollars supporting Saudi Arabia and Lebanon and what have you? Because of our interests. What are our interests? Oil? Well, how about if we get the hell off of oil almost immediately? Maybe then that wouldn't be one of our interests. Here's one of our interests. And I was going to read this in different order. All of you are familiar with the situation in Tajikistan. I can't even say it. Tajikistan, right? Oh yeah, everybody. Tajikistan.
No, everyone knows what's going on in Kazakhstan because of Borat.
Yeah. Well, this is right next door. Tajikistan was one of the Central Asian Soviet republics.
Right.
And this article, let me see, was in Reuters, and it's from, I don't even know how to pronounce the name of the capital, Dushanbe, Dushanbe. Here's the article. Corruption, red tape, and the lack of both free media and independent courts are holding back Western investment in the Central Asian Republic of Tajikistan, said the U.S. ambassador. This is Bush's ambassador, who is Tracy Ann Jacobson. She said corruption is a big issue, bribery, conflicts of interest. So, and it goes on and on. Let's see. In a move charged with symbolism, President Emomali Rahman this month shed the Russian ending on his surname, saying he wanted to emphasize his Persian roots. In power since 1992, so he's a dictator. He's been in there for 15 years. He was known as Rachmanov and emerged on the winning side of a civil war. So what are we doing here? This is another article, and this is in the New York Times yesterday. Or Saturday. The nearly completed bridge over the Panj River makes an incongruous sight. More than 700 yards long, it is a sort of modern imposing concrete structure that might carry a rush of traffic over a gorge in the west, except there's nothing there at all.
We built the bridge?
Exactly. The bridge, underwritten by Washington.
Oh.
That's us. That's you and me. I don't want to say us. We know we're not making war on Iraq. George Bush is making war
on Iraq.
But we have underwritten this bridge designed by the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Maybe that's why they didn't take care of all the dikes in New Orleans.
Well, really? We're over there building bridges for what?
Well, for future commerce.
Ah.
You know, the pipe of Landistan, right? That's enough.
That was the pipeline in Afghanistan.
Yeah, is that not pipe Landistan? Pipe.
That sounded good.
Yeah, but it was something else. Pipe Linistan, that's it.
Oh.
Pipe Linistan, right.
Right.
So the bridge, underwritten by Washington and designed by the United States Army Corps of Engineers, is at the center of plans to establish a trade route from Kazakhstan to Pakistan. Two of these totally whacked out dictatorships like Tajikistan. The corridor has been under construction for several years. So let's say, okay.
What the hell are we doing? They doing over there?
And you say, all right, come on, how much does this damn thing cost us? And you got to go to the end of the article.
Okay.
In all, the project will cost more than $52 million.
What?
So folks, we are financing. You and me, think of us, think of Michigan, think about that we might have to have a raise in our income tax here. We're going to have to cut back on all, you know, sports at our universities. I forgot all the other stuff that they're talking about cutting. But the United States, under George W. Bush, has money to build a bridge over the River Panj, P-A-N-J, in Tajikistan, Nizhny Panj, Tajikistan. Wow. That's where it is.
Yeah, and you're right. They're not taking care of New Orleans. You know, yeah, who's taking care of New Orleans? People like you and me, people who have donated, people like Brad Pitt, for crying out loud, and Sean Penn, and, yeah, you know, Hollywood. It's really pathetic.
So they think they're going to, let me see, the project described, American officials described the investment as a long-term bet.
I don't get it.
They're betting. You know why they can bet? Because they ain't betting with their money.
Right.
They're betting with our money.
Oh, yeah, it's really fun to gamble, yeah, with other people's money, for sure.
I mean, aren't these high crimes and misdemeanors?
Yes.
Shouldn't these people be impeached?
Yes.
Don't you think?
I do. Strongly.
Here's Andrew in Farmington Hills. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
Good. I like to comment on insurance companies frauding people, you know, basically ripping, you know, taking their money. And, you know, I pay a car note on my vehicle every month, and I pay my car insurance, you know, on time. And basically what I don't get is, you know, how can, I know, how do I put this? A bank that I pay, you know, the insurance, you know, car note with, they have insurance in case, God forbid, I total my vehicle.
Okay.
And I don't know, because something don't seem right, because they say I owe like $900 on my, you know, to this bank. And I'm like, what's going on? I'm paying my everything on time. So I feel like someone's pocketing my money.
Well, I don't know exactly what's happening. It's hard to, you know, figure out individual situations. But an old friend of mine, Danny Schechter, what do they call him? Danny Schechter, the media dissector, he has a new video out that I'm going to interview him about probably next week, called In Debt We Trust. And I was horrified at the manner in which the middle class and the working class and the poor, particularly in many cases the poor, are looted, essentially looted. I mean, people, particularly the poor, people that can afford to part with any of their money the least, are the heaviest hit by all these, you know, these scams, these, yeah, what they call predatory lending, check cashing,
right,
places, and borrowing on your...
And they need the money.
Yeah, you know, the working poor who, some of these firms like H&R Block and all that.
You borrow on your paycheck?
Borrow on your paycheck, borrow on your tax refund.
Oh, right, yes.
And some of the interest rates are up around 75%. Some of,
yeah,
them go as high as 500%.
So they're behind no matter what.
Yeah, and they almost get... LinkedIn forever to,
right,
these people.
Yeah, the system.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that, and by the way, like the bankruptcy law, which was written by the credit card companies.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Written by the credit card companies because after they had encouraged the worst loans, essentially, you know, they've loaned us money, the wealthy. That's what's happening. The wealthy are loaning the poor and the middle class and working class money at usurious rates. Usury, which was condemned by church officials in the Middle Ages as being morally unacceptable, at rates that are just skyrocketing all the time. And we are now, of course, working at a zero savings rate. For the first time in American history, people are spending more than they are saving.
Yeah.
And one of the things, the scariest thing, because this is precarious anyway, because if they create a situation where there was an economic downturn, a bad one, and people couldn't meet their credit card obligations.
Yeah.
What would happen to the overall financial picture in this country? And one of the things that that this guy said, there is $1 trillion of unused credit out there. That means, say, do you have any credit cards you don't use?
No.
I've got two. I have two. So, and each of them, I don't know, what do they usually have? $10,000, $15,000, $20,000?
Yeah, sure.
So if everything went totally south for me,
yeah,
I could say, whoa, and I could start charging on these cards.
Yes.
So what that would do, of course, would in a if there's an maybe you're kind of looking like what I'm maybe not explaining this well, but there's this unused credit suddenly like people like me start taking these other two credit cards
right.
and using them, and suddenly the rate of indebtedness just skyrockets.
Oh sure, yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck on it, my friend.
Yeah. Good
yeah.
luck.
All right. We'll be right back. 313. There's open lines where you've been trying all night. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-97.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Another dream goes up in the smoke. Huh.
Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And let's get turn that music down. Thank you. Jillian Jordan is with me. 313-298-WRIF in about 27 minutes at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. here on WRIF. I'm going to be interviewing Dale McGowan. I got his name spelled wrong, I think. Yeah, it's McGowan, not McCowan. Dale McGowan, who wrote Parenting Beyond Belief on Raising Ethical, Caring Kids Without Religion.
I think that's really interesting. And, you know, I always thought if I ever had kids, which I'm not going to, by choice.
Yeah.
And you're kind of the same way. You never did that same thing. But it was a real struggle because I knew that, like, my family would always say, you know, you need to raise those kids, take them to church. But I never would have done that. So I'm really looking forward to this interview.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very interesting interview.
Yeah, and in this country, not a real popular thing to do, to not introduce your kids to.
Well, there is at least about, I don't know, what do they think, 20, 30 million atheists in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But in a poll from, I wish I had the book with me, I think from 2005, and I remember reading it on the show, is that atheists were the least respected group of people in America. You know, people are so anti-Muslim, and atheists were below Muslims.
Really?
Yeah.
We were
above, like, serial killers, I think, but barely.
Oh,
but, you know, I've always thought, and I think I mentioned this last January, I read this article that in Las Vegas, there was this revelry going on New Year's Eve. And they were mostly young people in their 20s, and they were partying, they were drinking, they were doing drugs, women were taking their tops off, and people were just generally carrying on. And these preachers came and started saying, "You're sinful, you're going to rot in hell for your activity," and you see what they say. And these young people, they were, like, really offended and say, "Who are these people to tell us what to do or what our morality is?" But I'll bet you if you would have taken any of these people, a guy chugging down a beer, somebody smoking a doobie, a woman taking off her top, and you would have said to them, "Hey, do you believe in God?" And they'd go, "What? Oh, yeah." And said, do you believe in hell? Yeah. And do you believe the Bible is the literal word of God? And actually, you know what? I think... You know, I remembered when I told this last, I said this on the tape, maybe I shouldn't get that. And they would have said, do I think the Bible's literal word of God? Yeah, because socially to say no, it's fairly unacceptable.
Yeah, it is. But I guess I explain myself that I just kind of follow the laws of cause and effect in Buddhism, things like that. And when I say that to people, then it's okay.
And since you're dyslexic, you believe in dog.
Right, the church of the dyslexic dog.
Dog,
that's
yeah.
my church. That's
yeah,
our church.
Oh, that's right. Anyway, the other interview will be with Melissa Rossi, who has a whole series, What Every American Should Know. This is What Every American Should Know About Who Really Rules America. So you may want to check that out. 1 a.m. coming.
Interesting.
Coming up. Let's see. Here is an unidentified person. I don't have you on my screen. Hi, this is WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead. Maybe that's unidentified because there's no one there.
Maybe.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
No, yeah, I got cut off.
You're
yeah.
live.
Who are you?
I wanted to say what I heard what you said about the V for Vendetta thing.
Yeah.
And that's what got me to call. In my opinion, he's like Sherlock Holmes and, say Batman.
Yeah, right. That's what it was. Thank you. It was a combination between Zorro, Batman, and one other film. I can't think of it.
He said Sherlock Holmes.
Then Sherlock Holmes. Okay, it'd be Sherlock Holmes.
Oh.
I like the message, but I just thought the film was a little cheesy.
I haven't seen it.
Oh,
but
you really
can't
should.
Wait to see it, yeah.
But I do have to say something about the whole atheist thing.
Sure.
Because I'm one of them. Where it is we're really not that bad. The people that are worse are, I've seen Christians who do way worse things than any atheist I know.
The late Jerry Falwell, for example?
Well, here.
Or people on your block, even?
And this Dale McGowan, who is my guest at 1 o'clock, you won't even have to listen to it, because he said that there are stats about this. If you see what is the percentage of Catholics in prison compared to the Catholics in the general population, it's about the same. Methodists, the same down the line.
Interesting.
That there is 8 times less atheists in jail than they are representative in the general population. No, I don't know if I'm even saying that the correct way, but atheists are not heavily represented in the prison population.
That's
really not, because most of the time they're actually very good people.
They're historically, there's some pretty awful ones, I'll tell you.
That's true. But
yeah, they did some major damage, but I don't think it was because of their religious or values or left. Oh, you're Emilio.
Yeah.
Yeah, here, I got your name up here. Hi.
But the thing is, it's not that we don't believe in God. It's that we believe there is one. It's just we don't place faith in him. The ones that don't believe there is one.
Well, he's there, but I don't put any faith. Guy's messed up. Yeah, yeah. Well, what was I looking at the other day? I don't want to get into all this. All right, thank you, Amelia. Or maybe I will. I was at a Boston aquarium, and I was looking at, they're not called seahorses, sea dragons. You ever see one of these things?
Probably.
They live really at these extreme depths, and they're the oddest-looking little sea creatures you ever saw, you could ever imagine, and I'm thinking, these people think God created this? Yeah, what is this guy, you know? Well, I don't have anything to do today. I'm going to create all
The sea dragon. It will live at very deep depths or something.
All right, we were talking about Dr. Laura's son, Derek Schlesinger, who is this psycho freak who has had his blog or his MySpace page removed because... that he said, I love my job. It takes everything reckless and deviant and heathenistic. And this was realistic, right? And he says,
he's talking about his job in the armed services. Yeah.
And just overall bad about me, and hyper-focuses those traits into my job of running around this horrid place, which is Afghanistan, and doing nasty things to people that deserve it and some who don't.
Listen to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And
proud of your son, Laura.
Yeah. And his MySpace page had cartoon depictions of rape, murder, torture, and child molestations, including a photograph of a bound and blindfolded detainee captioned, "My sweet little Habib." Isn't that nice?
But disgusting.
Winston Smith, who always writes and signs his stuff, Winston Smith, who was the protagonist of 1984, Orwell's book, says, did you know that Dr. Laura posed for beaver shots, which I believe are still available via Google? That's true.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I didn't know she went that far.
She did.
You know what? I don't want to see it. Okay? That's disgusting.
I mean, this isn't recently.
I don't want to see her
30,
her
40 years
beaver,
ago.
Young or old.
Let's see. Deb from Ypsilanti writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I read something last week in the Sunday Detroit Free Press by Tim O'Brien that in May 2008, the Federal Real ID Act states that all states issued driver license and ID cards must include our personal info signature, social security number, and a machine readable zone to contain all data, which O'Brien continues is supposed to be used to see what products we buy and ID lost pets via power radio waves.
Oh.
Well, I don't know if it's all that, Deb, but they are talking about having this national ID.
Right. Well, I went to the casino once. It was probably, it's been a couple of years now downtown, and they took my license and they swiped it through before I could go in, which gave me the total creeps. I don't like that.
We had friends in from Germany. We just went to the Greektown casino.
Yeah.
Boy, those places are boring.
Oh.
We said, let's get a drink there. And it was so noisy because they got all that, you know, slot machine noise.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, people are heavy smokers in those things as well. And we said, you know what? I don't think we're going to get a drink here. And I said, let me play $10 worth. They dragged me out. They wouldn't let me do it. Al is listening in Rochester, New York. He says, I said I got rid of my 69 Ford GT convertible.
Yes.
He says, you're not alone. My grandfather had a 57 Chevy Bel Air, and he junked it. He says, I thought V for Vendetta was a great film, although I almost turned it off because of the scenes of the woman being tortured.
Oh.
You know, I watched it on DVD
and
knew that was coming.
So you fast-forwarded.
Yeah, I did. What a weenie, huh?
Well, I would do the same thing.
He says, yeah, I know it's just a movie, but I also know that my government is doing it for real. That makes me sick. But the ending was great as the people rose up against their oppression. It reminded me of 1984 and Friday the 13th because of the masks. Yeah, because V wears this mask because he's been... Phantom of the Opera.
Oh.
So it was a combination of Zorro...
It's coming to you now.
Yeah, because he... Zorro... Batman and Phantom of the Opera. Yeah. Okay. There you go.
Well, and that's it's all about the people rising up, and it's funny because I had this conversation with someone the other day, someone who works here, and he said, so you go out there, you stand on that street corner every Monday, not that street corner, but the one where we're protesting.
So yeah.
Protesting the war. You go to D.C. all the time, Julian, but nothing ever happens, nothing ever changes. Why do you keep doing it? And I said, because if you don't, then... They win. They truly win. Then you have sat down and you're doing nothing as if you don't care. You're giving them a carte blanche to go ahead.
Al from Rochester also writes, outstanding show tonight, Peter and Jolene. We have a very active counter-recruitment force here in Rochester, New York.
Oh, wow.
Now, Al, I owe you an email because you wanted some information from me, which I will get to. Please get your show posted on the website right away, the podcast. We had a meeting about that with our production people and Al Slayer, and I think we have it worked out that we are going to have it up. Because sometimes the production director, who just works his butt off.
He does. He does all the commercials and all the
promotion. And he gets slammed sometimes with so much work that he can't get the podcast on up till Thursday or something. So it should be there. He says he wants to, let me see. So I can... he's supposed to show so I can direct people to it. They will love it. I guess the counter-recruitment people will. Okay.
Let's see.
I can't get anything off today. There we go. It is Al from Inkster. Al, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hi.
How you doing tonight?
Good.
Are you familiar with the Gospel of Tom Waits?
The Gospel? I know Tom Waits, the singer, but...
Well, there's the Gospel of Tom Waits. In one of the songs, he goes, there is no devil, there's only God, and he is drunk.
Well, Tom Waits, he had a lot of songs about being drunk. The piano's been drinking.
He's an interesting character, Tom Waits.
Is he still alive?
Yeah.
He didn't pass, did he?
No, he's still around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know who I'm thinking of. Who is the drunk poet from the West Coast? Bukowski.
Bukowski, Charles Bukowski.
Charles Bukowski.
I was going to say, which drunk poet? I mean, you can name several.
That's right. All the poets I know are drunks.
Really?
You know, Dylan Thomas.
Yeah, he's drunk. Yeah, he was.
Are they inspired by the alcohol? Is that,
I don't know.
Depressed? Or,
yeah. Huh. Thank you, Al. Thank you very much. Another place where our money is going, did you see, again, I mean, most people don't even see this stuff, Jalal Talabani, who is the president of Iraq. I think they're off on vacation, by the way.
They've had so many...
No, not the prime minister. He is the president. He's
I don't know what that means.
I don't know. Well, a lot of countries have, like Israel has a prime minister who is Olmert, and then the president. I can't remember the president. I think they're
kind of like England, like Britain.
Well,
the prime minister and then the monarch.
Yeah. Well,
but same but different.
All of a sudden, I can't remember how the president. Never mind. I don't know. Parliamentary. President of Iraq, this is an old article, kicks off a 3-week trip to the U.S. with a visit to the White House. Actually, the reason he came here is to lose weight.
What?
Yeah, he went to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. He was hospitalized for exhaustion in February after collapsing in Jordan, but says he mainly needs to relax and lose some weight. So, they don't have any money over there, so we're paying for it again, you and me. So we're paying for old Jalal Talabani to come to the United States and do a little spa. Right?
Unreal.
It is unreal. It is all unreal.
Ugh.
It is so terribly unreal. Let's see. What else did I want? Oh, yeah. You wanted to talk. We never did get to this, did we? I have two things. I'm just looking at
the cocaine in Rome?
Tell me about that. I remember, yeah.
That was a story. There was a study. Here it is right here. Scientists have discovered particles of cocaine and marijuana as well as caffeine and tobacco in the air in Italy's capital of Rome. Isn't that interesting? It's a concentration of drugs that was heaviest in the air around Sapienza University.
Well, a number of years ago, this could even have been in the late 80s, when well, I guess cocaine is still big, but it was all of it's all we were talking about. Actually, people don't talk about cocaine and crack any longer, but it's still it's about at the same level of consumption. In fact, the war on drugs has been such a catastrophic failure that all it's done, again, is waste billions and billions of dollars, incarcerate people, well, the clients for the prison industrial complex.
Right.
And has done nothing to stop the availability of drugs, which I say are cheaper. In fact, our pals in Afghanistan, once the Taliban was gone, who forbid poppy growing,
it's now
at record levels. The poppy production, poppy crops are
right.
They're
back. The Taliban level. Did they destroy them all?
Yeah, they
destroyed all the poppy fields, and now they're all back.
And they did so well that in April of 2001, that Bush gave $42 million to the Taliban.
Yes, yes, I remember that. Was before we went,
yeah. Wasn't there, there's, hey, Mr. Taliban, tally me bananas?
Oh, right.
You could say, hey, Mr. Taliban, tally me poppies? Or something like that. So let me see. War on drugs. Do you have any idea where I was? Do you keep me on focus, or do you make me more disturbed?
Cocaine in the air.
Cocaine. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So in the late 80s, there was this man. I've told this story before. You may remember this. He was caught with several million dollars in cash, but no drugs. And the federal government prosecuted him because they subjected this currency that he had to spectral analysis and showed this cocaine residue on all the $50 and $100 bills that were in the satchel. The defense went to the Treasury Department and got shredded $50 and $100 bills. And you can get them there. You can get them you know, for different little, I don't know, what do people want it for? But they get it. And he had that subjected to spectro analysis and found out that all of America's currency, big dollars, all had residues of cocaine on it.
Because everyone's rolling it up. Rolling it up and snorting it.
Yeah, or I don't even know from that. That would take a lot. I mean, just probably a lot of these big bills are present while people are doing.
You could say so.
Yeah, something like that. 313-298-WRIF. It's John in Roseville. John, it's Peter and Jillian. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing great.
I just heard something the other day on another radio program about a new street drug that is supposed to be extremely cheap. It's called cheese. Have you heard anything about
it? What's it called?
Cheese?
Cheese, yes.
I have heard something.
It's supposed to have the consistency of, like, a grated Parmesan cheese, and it's got, I believe they said, black tar heroin in it, but a very small trace, cold medicine, and it's supposed to be, like, $2 for a small portion to get you high.
Well, John.
It's very addictive.
I wonder how many thousands of people just out there said, huh.
Where can I get that?
Right.
Very highly addictive. Highly addictive. Black tar heroin is not something you want to mess with.
Right.
Yeah.
And they said be careful. They said that all of your the drug dealers want your fifth grade child to try this stuff. That's how young they're going, is trying to get kids in fifth grade hooked on this stuff.
Well, you know where kids in fifth grade learn about things like this, not through this program, but through the DARE programs that are going to schools that have been another massive failure.
Right.
Because what they tend to do is tell kids about drugs that they've never heard of before, because DARE always wants to really be on top of things.
Oh, right.
They would say, and of course, cheese is very dangerous, too, that you, when they describe what drugs do to you, generally people
that
say,
sounds good.
Yeah, that's why I do it.
Well, the addiction part, the highly addictive part is the reason why I personally would stay away from anything that was highly addictive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, have a good night. I just want to know if you had if you had heard about that. So
I've heard something very briefly about that, but you know, I knew someone who put a DARE sticker on their car who was like, to try to thwart the cops.
Yeah, because they were probably...
I knew a few people who did that.
Yeah, I mean, marijuana dealers that I knew, they would have support your local police stickers on their car.
Right.
So, figure it out, people. Whenever you see a support your local police or something like that, it's...
They're probably doing
they're
it.
They're probably a drug dealer. All right, thank you, John. And I wonder if the cops knew this. You know, we never got around to Cindy Sheehan, did we? We talked about these right-wingers want to buy her property.
Yeah.
What about Ted Nugent? Maybe he'll...
He's down there in Crawford now.
Yeah, maybe he should buy it. Cindy Sheehan.
She won't sell it to him. She wouldn't. She said she won't sell it to this right-wing organization. What it is, and we'll give a little history, is Camp Casey, everyone knows, well, not everyone, but some of you. Cindy Sheehan set up camp across from Bush's compound down there in Crawford, called Camp Casey, named after her son who died in Afghanistan. And so she bought this property for something like $50,000. I didn't know this. I didn't know that she owned that property.
Yeah.
She got it
for the insurance money.
Yeah. From the insurance money, that she got from her son's death. And now she wants to sell it as she's trying to move on in the next chapter of her life. And this right-wing organization, this pro-war organization, wants to buy it. She won't sell it to them.
And what is she asking? Like, she's going to put it on eBay, which is pretty weird.
Oh, I didn't see that part.
And her spokesperson said, "We're not going to use the land as an." Oh no, this is the spokesman for the group. She said, "We're not going to use the land as an anti-Cindy Sheehan statement. We want to take this land, used to undermine troops, and turn it around." Now, Cindy Sheehan has done more for the troops in Iraq than all of these right winger cheerleaders. You know. Whenever you see these groups that are pro-war, they've always got these young right-wing young people that they want to support the troops. Let them go over there.
Yeah.
No way in the world. No way in the world. Hey, we're out of time. Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
And thanks to all of you for listening and calling. And remember, stay tuned. In fact, the first interview out of the box is going to be about raising kids with atheist parents.
Mm.
Talk next week.
On the air.
Is WRIM.com. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Some of you may remember that I cited a study was done, I think, 2 years ago now, and they where people responded that they would rather have their daughter marry a Muslim. And given all the prejudices we have of people that adhere to Islam, think about this. They'd rather have their daughter marry a Muslim than an atheist. So atheists were really at the bottom of the heap. I mean, the question is, if God is dead, isn't everything and anything permissible? Don't we need a spiritual understanding and ethically centered life in order to not be immoral people? Well, there's about 40 million of us, and I'm a non-believer, so I include myself in that, and I've never had children, but I always wondered, I mean, I was brought up in a home where neither religion nor God played any role, but I always wondered how other people went at it. Well, here's an extraordinarily interesting book came my way. It's called Parenting Beyond Belief on Raising Ethical, Caring Kids Without Religion. It's edited by Dale McGowan, and Dale McGowan is joining us. He's a writer, editor, and critical thinking educator in Minneapolis. His satirical novel, Calling Bernadette's Bluff, has been called, quote, an undoubted triumph of satire and wickedly funny. He's the father of three, and he and his wife are the father of three, so he has some direct experience in this. Dale McGowan, thanks for joining us from Minneapolis.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Peter. Thanks.
Well, so maybe we could just begin, as they say, the personal is political. You, as a non-believer, and tell me if I'm not characterizing you correctly, have three children, so you were faced with raising ethical, caring kids without religion. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So tell us how this intersected in your personal lives, you and your wife, raising children, and also with the generation of this book, Parenting Beyond Belief.
Well, it was an issue. I've actually been a non-believer for a good 25 years. I've been a parent for about 12. So it became an issue once those two intersected, and I went looking for resources. There are a lot of things that come up right away living in a predominantly religious culture, and trying to raise kids to negotiate and navigate those straits, and just didn't find anything out there to help out with it. So I began pulling together some ideas for the book and writing some essays, and I had a couple of them published online and so on, but still wanted to get something that was going to have even a wider point of view than I was able to give myself. So I eventually came up with the idea of pulling together contributors. Eventually ended up with about 25 people from a wide range of spectrums within disbelief, all talking about this issue of raising kids without religion.
And how does it work in your household? And maybe I can even tell you after you tell me, I'll tell you how it worked in mine.
Oh, sure. The question of religion is the same as the question of everything else I want my kids to encounter. I want them to have all the information they possibly can and think for themselves. And that means I have to avoid trying to put my point of view in a position of just being something they glom onto. If they do that, it's going to be on a very weak foundation. So if they appear to be heading too far in the direction of what I believe, I try to throw them some information from the other side or have them seek out the information from other people outside. So it's no different in religion than any other way. When we're talking about questions of God and faith and so on, and they've heard my point of view, I then say, hey, why don't you go talk to Grandma Barbara? I know she thinks differently. You can get some more information from her.
Mm-hmm. Now, you teach critical thinking, and that you just gave an example of it. On the other hand, some people might say, well, that's a great way to confuse kids, because you have these authority figures, us adults, and you got Dad saying, no God, sorry, ain't happening, it's all a myth. And then you got Grandma saying, yes, you know, the Lord will have us in his hands and you know, we'll all meet in heaven. I mean, now how does a child know how to sort that all out?
Oh, they do just fine. I think it's like so many things. Whatever model a kid sees from the beginning, they accept as normal. And if they accept as normal the idea that adults come to different conclusions, then they recognize that they have the right to come to various conclusions on their own. It won't be something that's strange. If instead they're born into a situation where dad's the authority and whatever dad says goes, then they confront the kind of the messy world of ideas later on, and it can be quite confusing. But my kids have never had any trouble with the idea that there are lots of different landing places, and then it's up to them to decide where they go.
Mm-hmm. Dale McGowan is my guest, and he has edited Parenting Beyond Belief on Raising Ethical, Caring Kids Without Religion. And we'll talk about some of the contributors to the book in just a little while. I know when I was growing up, when I was small, that the United States being one of the more religious Western countries in the world, that I always felt kind of on the outside, not believing in anything. I don't remember any discussions. I think I probably just asked my mother or dad, did God exist? And they probably just said no. And that was it. But I know when I lived in a Christian, predominantly Christian neighborhood, and kids went to church every Sunday, and my parents were very liberal, and they said, well, you can go to church if you want. Instead, I went to a YMCA camp, and remember just being kind of frightened by the imagery and the threats of going to hell, because I was a bad little boy. And then we moved into a predominantly Jewish neighborhood, and all of the kids were about to have bar mitzvahs, and I wondered, then I found out that the people went to services, they went to Hebrew school after school, and they went to services on Saturday. I said, that doesn't sound good to me. So, but, I told it a bit for humor, but actually, I felt like an outsider. I felt like I was, and a couple of times in situations like in the Boy Scouts, I was confronted by adults demanding to know how could I put forth such a preposterous proposition that God did not exist.
Yeah.
So how do your kids interact with essentially a religious country?
Well, it's there are a whole range of topics in there in those things you were describing, and
sure.
I think it varies depending on which one you're talking about. Really, if there's one overriding challenge in raising kids without religion, it's that whole barrel of monkeys right there. How do you deal with the intersection of religion and your family life? So it's not difficult at all to raise children who are ethical and caring. It's not difficult to talk about death and so on. But then, like you say, interacting with the outside world, interacting with the Boy Scouts, for example. My boy was a Cub Scout initially, and he began to be uncomfortable with the way this religious pledge has become even a higher profile recently than it used to be. And we talked it out, and he said, I really don't want to be a part of it anymore. And it wasn't just about that. It was about some other things as well. But he ended up making a choice. We gave it entirely over to him, and he decided that was just not something he was comfortable with. Then you've got things like the Pledge of Allegiance. The book talks about several different ways to handle the Pledge of Allegiance thing, including letting the child simply go through the ritual of saying under God or whatever it is. There are all sorts of possibilities. Some people decide that they want to take a stand and want to help their child to take a stand, and others are saying, well, you really need to find out where the child is, and it depends on how old they are, how much they're willing to take on. So one of the things I like most about the way the book came together is that there isn't a single voice. It's a lot of people advocating different ways of approaching these topics.
Well, Dale McGowan, this is being aired on Sunday. I suspect some people are probably either going or coming from church. And one of the reasons that people say to me that why they've started going to a church or a synagogue, or in some cases, well, I guess just churches or synagogues in the terms of the people I know, is that they say, well, you know, I never really went, but I'm raising kids and I want to give them some ethical grounding. And the assumption there is you're going to be raising some, insufficient human beings if they don't see Ten Commandments, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. Speak to them. I mean, there's people riding home in the car. They're coming from church. And how are you going to raise an ethical, caring kid if you don't have the grounding of religion?
Well, first of all, one of the things that I try to make clear in the book is that if there is someone who believes that's the case, then they should go for it. If that's what they want, I'm not trying to recruit anybody away from religion. But those who have decided to be outside of it find no difficulty whatsoever raising ethical kids. What you do is you teach children that ethics are grounded in reason. And the fact is, this is no different from religious parents. I have religious parents look at me in one moment, friends of mine, and say, gosh, without the Ten Commandments, I'd have no idea what was right and wrong. And then they turn around to their child and say, don't hit Billy. How would you feel if he hit you?
Yeah.
You know, they just explained a reason to be good. The fact is, all of our ethics are grounded in reason, and we all explain the reasons to our children, explain to them why it's important to be good. And then religious parents simply add this coda. They say, well, and God wants us to treat each other well.
it's not the centerpiece even of their own ethical teaching. So there's really no trouble in doing it without that coda.
Is there any, I just thought of this off the top of my head, I don't get this, I haven't read all the essays in your book, Parenting Beyond Belief, but is there any, like studies or statistics as how this all falls in terms of criminality or other things that we would all agree are social negatives and how people are, believers or not? Is there?
Yeah, there are a couple of studies along those lines. One of them that's very interesting is simply a one study took a look at the prison population in the U.S. They looked at federal prisons, and upon admission to the institution, prisoners are asked what their religious preference is, so that if they die or in some need of a religious figure, they know which way to send them. And actually, in that study, there are about the same percentage of Catholics in the federal penitentiary system as there are in the population. There are about the same percentage of Protestants as there are in the population. But there are 80 times fewer atheists in the prison system than you would expect given the number in the population. So if you take that indication alone, these are tremendously, if anything, ethically obsessed people. I know dozens and dozens of atheists and humanists who I would count among the most ethically concerned people I know. And that's why the popular misconception is so preposterous and unfortunate, because these are people who actually think about their ethics, who actually try to figure out why it is that we should be good and why we should take care of each other, because there's no divine safety net. One of the other studies that that I think is important is the piece on commandments versus principles, and they talk about the fact that a sociologist set up a study in which there were moral dilemmas and presented it to people in the study to determine what was the right action and the wrong action in a given situation. There's a train that's running out of control toward a person on the tracks, and you can either save the five people on the train or the one person on the track and so on. And what he did is determined how different the answers were between religious people and people who did not have a religious affiliation. And the key finding of the study was that there was essentially no statistical difference whatsoever. These people were making the same kind of judgments in the same situations, regardless of their religious upbringing or lack thereof.
The book is Parenting Beyond Belief, pardon me, on raising ethical, caring kids without religion. My guest is Dale McGowan, and he's edited an incredible array of essays, and I keep promising we're gonna get to them. I have just maybe one more little aspect till we get into some of the contributors, and that is when I said earlier the United States is designated as the most religious of the Western nations. In fact, very, very few people in European countries are religious. Very, the church attendance is getting close to zero in some European countries, but here, almost when people like Sam Harris's book, Letter to a Christian Nation, that he cites these statistics of what percentage of people believe in hell and that the return of Jesus in our lifetime and all of that. And, I wonder what you think about that, Dale McGowan, because I tend to think that a lot of the express religiosity is about a mile wide, but an inch deep. And just one little example, there was a news story that I read this last New Year's, where there was this huge revelry going on in the streets of Las Vegas, and some women had their tops off, and it was like Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like the worst imaginable to to a devout religious person situation one could imagine. And there were these two preachers there that started telling people, you're sinning, you're going to hell. And these predominantly young people were outraged that these preachers came in their midst, and they said, who are they to tell us how to live our lives? But I suspect if you went to each one of these young people, the woman without the top, the guy guzzling beer, and you said to him, do you believe in God? He'd probably say, huh? Oh, yeah. Do you believe in the divinity of Jesus? Yeah. Do you think that the Bible is the divine word of God? Yes. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What? Can you speak to that at all?
Well, you're actually speaking to my primary audience. I honestly believe that the numbers, the statistics cited, 30 to 40 million non-believers in the U.S. are way low. But in fact, people have, like you said, about an inch deep
religiosity. They don't know there's an alternative. They, especially parents, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, they have no idea that there is an ethical mainstream alternative to simply dragging yourself to church and muttering that you believe. And I want to show in as many ways as possible that there are an awful lot of people out there doing this already, and that everything that's achieved by going to church or by muttering those religious words can be achieved without it. And I think Europe, you mentioned European countries, it's a wonderful example. If you look at the Scandinavian countries, it's a fascinating statistic that they have the lowest church attendance in the Western world and the highest percentage of giving to the poor and also giving to poor nations internationally. They have the lowest rates of violent crime. They have the lowest rates of things like teen pregnancy and so on. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think these are countries in which ethics are articulated, and these are people living a moral life without religion, and they can do it because they are surrounded by other people who are doing it, and they know that it's not that big a deal to simply let go of the lip service that you pay to religious ideas.
All right, let's go into the book. The book is Parenting Beyond Belief on Raising Ethical Caring Kids Without Religion. It's edited by Dale McGowan, our guest on the Peter Werbe Show. If you want to see more about this book, you can go to parentingbeyondbelief.com, parentingbeyondbelief.com. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. You assembled over 20 essays to speak to this, to how to parent beyond belief. And I just opened just randomly to page 142. And one of the things you want to look at it are what kind of role models do we have for people that have made a difference in our world? And here is a list of non-believers, atheists, free thinkers, what agnostics, whatever you would want to call them, American revolutionaries, celebrities, novelists, reformers, and scientists, feminists. So those of us who are free thinkers or non-believers, we certainly have, and children certainly have a lot of people to be put forth as role models.
Oh, absolutely. That's why I wanted to include that piece especially. Annie Laurie Gaylor wrote that, who could have written on a dozen different topics, but this is something that's systematically erased from our history. We know about Thomas Edison, we know about Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, we know all these figures, but we only assume that they were observant Christians. In the case of those names and this incredible chapter of additional names, they were not. They were religious doubters of various stripes. And I think it makes a tremendous difference. I didn't know this myself until I was in my early 30s and started uncovering this incredible history of disbelief. But we sort of systematically go through and erase that from our history as much as possible to give the impression that everybody is a pious believer.
Yeah, the novelists, the list of novelists, which I won't read because it would probably take to the end of the show, both right-wingers like Ayn Rand and people that are more associated with the left, Gore Vidal and Kurt Vonnegut and Alice Walker and H.G. Wells going back a ways, just a tremendous number of people. So... But this is not set up as a program, nor is the book, to attack people that are religious. Am I correct?
No, absolutely. One of the reasons is that there's no point. It's as if I want to put my energy into converting people, I would have taken a very different approach. What I want to do is say there's already an enormous underserved population here. And there's no reason for us to create a book that attacks the beliefs of somebody else. The idea here is to say, okay, we are here together. We've arrived at this point in our own beliefs. How can we raise the best possible children? So, no, it doesn't have to engage in religious attack.
And there's a minister somewhere. He was, I can't remember the story completely. The man that says that Jesus died for our sins, all of us, atheists, mass murderers, Hindus and Buddhists. So that's it. If it turns out we're wrong, Dale, according to him, we're taken care of. Anyway, tell us about some of the essays. Probably the most famous one is Richard Dawkins, whose book, The God Delusion, has been on the New York Times bestseller list for the longest time. He writes open letters, so to speak, to an 11-year-old.
Right, that's right, to his daughter, on good and bad reasons for believing. It's a wonderful piece.
Yeah, yeah. And tell us about some of the other people that we may have heard of as well.
Sure. Well, there's Julia Sweeney, formerly of Saturday Night Live. She's begun in the last few years, she's really become more vocal about her own disbelief and about her moving away from Catholicism. And so her essay is the first one in the book, and it's just terrific. It's just wonderful, personal, funny, and poignant piece. And Julia was the first one I contacted. I wanted to see if she'd be able to do this. She got back to me in 90 minutes with a yes. This is the kind of reaction I had from all the contributors. I let them know about the idea, and it took them virtually no time to say yes. They all just said it was long overdue. Some of the others, we've got Penn Jillette, of course, passing down the joy of not collecting stamps. Just a great piece. He's just a brilliant guy, and he's got this no-holds-barred, no-nonsense approach to the thing that...
this is from Penn and Teller.
From Penn and Teller, right. Yeah, exactly. So those are kind of bookends in the personal reflections chapter. We've got Julia Sweeney, who's got this kind of, you know, gosh, I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know, approach. And Penn Jillette, who really doesn't care. So you can find yourself in any one of the approaches there.
Well, do you think that there's been a sea change? I mentioned a couple of years ago, I don't know if you saw that study, where people put atheists at the bottom rung of acceptable partners for their children.
Yeah.
Yet, I think with all the hypocrisy that has been come forth, the corruption about the politicized right-wing Christians, that suddenly atheism, the books about it, Dawkins and others have hit the bestseller list. Synchronicity that Parenting Beyond Belief has come out now.
Yeah.
I think suddenly non-believers are getting a hearing.
Yeah, I think that's true. When the first Bush election in 2000, I remember being at this convention, being surrounded by all these moping progressives, and I just said, "This is a great time. This is actually the best possible thing for us because now it's out in the open. You know, there are all sorts of horrible things that are going to come out of it, but in another way, it's not under the surface anymore. We can really, really see the results of this kind of nonsense, and that's going to be a painful thing to go through. Believe me, I haven't enjoyed it. But in another way, it's allowed us to finally get off our butts and start articulating our point of view instead of doing this sort of wishy-washy, you know, on the sidelines thing. I think that's also permitted a large number of people who've been in the middle and haven't really thought too much about these issues to say, you know what, I'm willing to recognize that there are actually some harmful effects of religion that I want to stay away from, and that when we start to get it involved in the government, it's an atrocious thing.
Yeah, well, I always say one nation under God, Iran. That's one of your worst examples. Yeah, it historically, the intertwining of the political state and religion has always corrupted both of them.
Right.
Without a doubt. We've only got about a minute or so left. Have you had any reaction to your book, Parenting Beyond Belief, either positive or negative? I know it's just come out.
Yeah, well, it's been out for about 6 weeks, I guess, and there's been a lot of reaction, and I've been stunned at how positive it's been across the board. I was prepared. I was getting my arguments ready and prepared from either side, both from atheists who would think it's occasionally too accommodating of religion and from religious people who think that it's too disdainful. And there hasn't really been much of that at all. People tend to say, you know what? If this is a resource that's needed to make parents better parents, then more power to you. There's been a lot more of that than any of the negatives, so I've been pleased.
Well, I noticed that you have an essay by Dan Barker and also one by Ann Nicole Gaylor, both who have been on my show a couple of times,
right.
Who are the co-directors of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and their organization it has just been growing by leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
I mean, thousands and thousands of people. So, I mean, you think it is sort of a coming out of the closet?
Yeah, I think there's been a critical mass reached in some way. There's what you have to do, it makes sense no matter what topic you're talking about. Nobody wants to plunge in and be alone. And if you can really feel like there's a community around you, other people who are coming to the same conclusions, it makes it much more possible for people to come out and say, yeah, you know what, I don't believe either.
Now, you have on the back, do we have time? I don't think I have time for this question. I've got so many questions, but That's why you wrote a book. That's why you edited the book with so many engaging and challenging, particularly for the religious, so many challenging essays in this Parenting Beyond Belief subtitle. And this is the important part for you parents on raising ethical, caring kids without religion. It's edited by my guest, Dale McGowan, and that's MCGOWAN. Best way to get at it, parentingbeyondbelief.com, parentingbeyondbelief.com. There'll also be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Dale, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, absolutely. I've been glad to be here.
This is WRIN.com. your hands on a sweet new 2007 Harley Davidson Custom 1200 XL Sportster.
You're a winner. You got a key.
No way.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
And a 2-year lease on a Ford F-150 XLT truck.
Steve, you're calling number 36, brother.
Thank you.
Then keep your radio locked on 101 WRIR to win a key to these sweet wheels. June 16th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights.
And that, you got it.
Okay.
Plus, every RIV key winner will be registered in a weekly drawing to also win a $1,000 gas card. Also, listen for details on Harley Bug Nights all around the Motor City where you can win a key in person. Motor City Harley Davidson's Harley Fest 2007. Also presented by Miller Lite, Royal Ford.
Who is hooking you up in the Motor City?
Oh, the RIV for sure. 101 WRIR. Everything that rocks. The pictures, the podcast, the blog,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall lose yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever and they always say something funny right before the commercial break.
Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. So frequently we talk on this program about what makes this country run? What's the roots of decision making? Is it really a democracy where you and I are the major players, or are there really power elites who make it all? Actually, there was a book 50, 60 years ago by a sociologist named C. Wright Mills called The Power Elite. And he said, it ain't you and me. It is a power elite. It is a command center that is insulated from popular control. Now, we're saying, well, wait a minute. That's not the way it's supposed to be. G. William Domhoff in the 60s and then a reissue in the 1980s wrote a book called Who Rules America? And again, it was that power elite. In many ways, that's the way it was from the beginning. That is to say that it was wealthy white men who set up the Constitution the United States of America. And for a long time, it was only they who could even vote. You had to be a white propertied male in order to be part of it all. Well, there's been a long struggle, a couple hundred years and more, to bring the rest of us in. And it's still an ongoing struggle. And ultimately, I think it's a struggle between the elites and us, the people that are supposed to make the decisions in a democracy. Well, joining me after that extraordinary long introduction is someone who I've had on the show a couple of times before that makes it pretty easy to understand these things. She's Melissa Rossi, and she's written a brand new book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running America, and best of all, What You Can Do About It. Now, Melissa Rossi has been on the show before. She's a former National Geographic traveler, columnist, and a special correspondent for Newsweek. She's an award-winning journalist and has been all around the globe bringing geopolitics to the masses. That's you and me. And I don't think there's any way, you know, we don't like to be the masses. But really, these come out in a way that you can understand. Melissa Rossi, should I get you on the show finally?
Well, hi there, Peter.
All right. Welcome. And what's even more interesting about this, you're in Thailand right now, aren't you?
Indeed, I am. I'm in the jungles of Chiang Mai, where, Peter, you wouldn't believe it, every night there is a chorus of insects, and it changes weekly. But this week, it's the kamikaze, like downward flying, just a horrible, horrible humming noises. Meow, meow. So I get that for hours. But and then it's very interesting. I've learned a lot about nature. Let's just put it that way.
Well, you do travel all over the world, because when we talked yesterday to set this up, you said, well, I could call you when I get to the Middle East. It's you know, it's like somebody, they're in Toledo, and they'll say, I'll call you when I get to Cleveland. But
right, I'm going to Oman, I'm going to Dubai, I'm going to Bahrain and Syria. So it should be really wild. I will call you from there if you want.
Oh, indeed. Well, tell us one thing. This is not the first book which has the title, which employs the phrase, What Every American Should Know. And we've interviewed you on a couple more about, and remind us, one was What Every American Should Know About Who Runs the World, right?
Right, who's really running the world. The first one was What Every American Should Know About the Rest of the World.
Right.
Then one just came out a few months ago about Europe, because I spent a lot of time traveling around Europe and living in assorted parts of that. And so with this one actually dovetails with the first one you mentioned, Who's Really Running the World,
mm-hmm.
in that this takes, that's a broader spectrum, and this one takes a close-up at some of the power, again, that power elite in D.C., but who's influencing them and how they're doing it? And, of course, you know, we all know Jack Abramoff was involved in this, but he's sort of been played up as, you know, the evildoer and
the lobbyist who was a friend of Tom DeLay's and who is now in prison for influence peddling, essentially. You know, I'll tell you, Melissa Rossi, I very frequently just am filled with questions, and it's not like I don't have any. It's like I have too many. Here's this thick little book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running America, and I don't even know where to start. If you were giving a speech, here, I'll let you do my job. If you were giving a speech on this book, where would you begin? If you want to, here, you have an audience that's waiting to know what this book is about, where do you begin on this to tell people who's really running America?
Well, I'll tell you who's had a tremendous influence, and actually, of your neck of the woods, are the big three. And how they've had an influence is they've kept us dependent on oil because, simply, it was easier for them to work with the internal combustion engine. And that's the thing they knew and they were familiar with, and they didn't want to mess around with what they knew. So, as a result, not only have we stayed dependent on oil, but they didn't want to, well, gosh, back in the 60s, they didn't want to put in seatbelts. They said that was going to take them down. But they've been so adamant over the last few decades about not increasing fuel efficiency, and they've hired so many lobbyists that have been so effectively influencing lawmakers that we haven't seen the car efficiency go up. I mean, I think the Bush administration put up, like an eighth of a, mile per gallon or something. It was ridiculous, the figures that they've come up with. So as a result, we have incredibly inefficient cars, and they're powered mostly by petroleum, and we haven't got off the alternatives. But look what happened. Not only has that messed us up, because look at the price of oil and gasoline, but it's messed up the American economy and the local economy. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have been affected by the layoffs. And in the meantime, it's brought in, you know, foreign car makers who didn't, they saw the writing on the wall. They didn't hire the lobbyists to keep the car efficiency, the fuel efficiency standards down. They said, okay, we're going to have more adaptable cars that can run on different forms of energy. We're going to have really efficient cars. And so they won, but the consumers lost, and the big three has lost. So, you know, it's things like that where we shoot ourselves in the foot by this lobbying system, and it's not just Jack Abramoff and his cronies. It is chronic, and it's a part of the election system. It's a part of campaign finance now. They are so important in being able to turn over, you know, $50,000 at a time, whether it's through fundraising dinners or being treasurers of PACs. So that's what I look at. That's one thing I look at is how. Not only who has been really influential, but how they've done it.
Well, as you know, that's interesting because most people would think, well, I don't have any say in what type of automobile is other than my purchase choices. I have to buy a car, and I kind of buy what's there, and everybody's buying these big SUVs, and I'll buy a big SUV. So we expect that to be a proprietary concern. It's their stuff. But your very title of your book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running America, that suggests, does it not, the thesis that I was putting forth at the beginning, this isn't you and me and Jim and Jane down the block. This is, I mean, do you subscribe to that? That in fact, the power centers really are the elites, a small number of elites in this country, and not the average person who's plunking down a vote every 4 years.
Yes and no. I mean, I think there is a power elite. I'm trying to remember the number there that they say, really, there's like 500 people in D.C. that control the policy in the U.S. There's a certain school of thought that subscribes to that belief. But in the same way that the lobbyists and their clients have had a tremendous effect on that small number of people, the voters, really, when it comes down to it, they need the votes. And if voters get into the faces of the politicians a little more and do it at a local level or the regional level, at the state level, I mean, even instead of going to D.C., you know, get the guy's office in his district and really campaign, I think you can have an effect. And one of the things I also look at in the book is how individuals, you know, just ordinary individuals have had a major impact on everything, you know, from immigration to the state of the Republican Party right now. So, I mean, there are, and I look at some of this, and Grover Norquist, for instance,
Remind us each time when you're talking about some of these people. I think most people will know, but always for those that don't, a kind of refresher. So Grover Norquist is a Republican operative, not elected to anything, but an extraordinarily powerful man in Washington with the Bush administration.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And he runs Americans for Tax Reform. And it's sort of in a lot of ways, it has a lot of libertarian ideas. You know, shrink the government down to the size of a bathtub so you can drown it is one of his famous lines.
Yeah.
They may have botched there. He's actually a very bright and kind person, but he has brought in a lot of different factions of the conservative and of the Republican Party and united them under this platform and has really, really shaped what the Republican platform is now. So he's one person. There's another guy that I'm sure very few people have heard of, named John Tanton. He's an eye doctor, a retired eye doctor now in a small town in Michigan. And he became very influential in the whole immigration thing because his concept or his fear was that all these people are coming in and they're having more children than the people that lived here before. So the Hispanic population in particular was frightening to him. So he, over the past decade or more, has gone through and really tried to pep people up about not having a second language in schools and not even, you know, if you call on a phone, you know, the option of, you know, press 9 for Spanish or whatever, trying to really cut down the other languages. And he worked it that way, but what he really wanted to do was shut the door. And look what's going on now with that wall going up, you know, a few billion dollars that I think is actually probably going to be very ineffective.
On the border, yeah.
And, you know, another group that I look at is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is in many ways a very, you know, helpful group, obviously pro-business. That's what they have, like 3 million businesses they represent. But what's happened in recent years is they've started to determine U.S. foreign policy. And if you want to know why we're going into India, and India is our best friend, it's because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been pushing for decades now to open that market, and now also using nuclear energy and getting that whole bandwagon on there, they've really pried it open and actually gotten India to change some of their laws. But they're controlling U.S. foreign policy. You know, they're the ones that helped to get, you know, China into the WTO. They've become a machine. And I think people need to look at them and what they're doing. Not only are they influencing the decisions as far as trade, but they're also influencing our elections because they do not like judges that rule in favor of consumers. And, of course, there's been some outrageous cases. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and some of their arms really almost fictionalize or, let's say, just really heavily publicize any absurd cases. And they make it that it sounds like the consumer is always wrong. And they have really secretly funded campaigns for judges that will not side with the consumer. So, I mean, they're just, in, they're, you know, they're in, they're trust, trust me, they're affecting your life in your city. They're affecting your life as far as your job capabilities and what you're going to get and what jobs are available. They're just affecting us all in a really big way. So look at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That's another one.
Melissa Rossi is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Her brand new book is What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running America and What You Can Do About It. We're talking with her by phone, obviously, from Thailand. The website that you'll want to go to is whateveryamericanshouldknow.com. I also have a link on my site, peterwerbe.com, as well. Now, tell me if we are actually going along the same lines. I'm saying that there's actually an elite, like a power elite, in the words of this sociologist from 50, 60 years ago, or like they said over 100 years ago, a plutocracy, the rule of the rich, that makes decisions in these insulated command centers that are not, I mean, although we obviously see how people change things all the time by voting, by mass movements and all of that. It, to some extent, what you're saying sounds like this is sort of democratic pluralism, that everyone tries for their own advantage, but there's sort of a balancing. Well, naturally, the Chamber of Commerce is going to push the interests of business, and labor unions would do that, and teachers would do what they were going to do. So is there, to my mind, there's an inherent disproportionate amount of power on the part of the elites. Is that what you see as well, or are you just sort of detailing who's got what power and decide for yourself?
I agree with you that there's a power elite. I think there's there's an influence machine on that power elite, and what it takes at this point often is a lot of money and some slick lawyers or former politicians, which many lobbyists now are, to go and influence that power elite. So the power elite has to get their funding and their power from somebody. And the way they've done it now is the lobbyists. I am also saying, however, that there are ways that individuals banding together particularly can make noise. And I saw something where the global warming has been denied. There's been a real campaign for a decade at least, and the big three was involved with it initially, as were the big oil companies. Now really only ExxonMobil is subscribing to the belief that there is no global warming, or scientists can't decide if humans have caused it, or, you know, maybe we're getting cooler. You know, there was a big disinformation campaign. The White House was a subscriber to that belief, too, and they really duped us and put out things like the Clear Skies Initiative, which, I don't know, it cut down the, amount of, I don't know, copper or pesticides or some ridiculous things. It had nothing to do with greenhouse gases and the things that actually cause global warming. So, but now, because the consumer or the typical American is getting very concerned about global warming, suddenly there's been reversals where, you know, Bush calls for us to get involved and talk about global warming. I don't think he'll ever push anything through, but then that at least they're getting together with other countries and talking about how to cut emissions when he took us out of the Kyoto Protocol the minute he stepped into office. And all this administration has done is loosen regulations. You know, that there's sort of a turnaround there. I think that's significant, and I think it's because of the American public saying, you know, what the heck are you doing?
Well, it's interesting. The first example you gave in our conversation about powerful groups within society, about who's running America, was the big three and their dedication to the internal combustion engine, which necessitates oil. And then you just mentioned the whole thing about global warming. Now, on the cover of your book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running America, the very first thing that's on there is who's behind America's nuclear renaissance. In other words, this power form that doesn't use oil, suddenly, but everybody thought it was a white elephant and was out of here, suddenly is making a resurgence. And I thought it was interesting. That's the first thing you point to. What? Tell me about that. Your concerns. Why it's up there number one? If it, I don't know if it's rank ordered, but it's right up there number one on your cover.
I think this is something that Americans need to be aware of. And now nuclear energy, because of global warming, is being sold as the clean, green, safe, you know, you can eat the nuclear waste, you'd think, after watching these ads that they're putting out there. This is a lot of propaganda. And what's good about nuclear energy is that it does not produce carbon dioxide, which is one of the major greenhouse gases, although it does indirectly, you can go into, you know, the transportation that's involved to create the nuclear fuel. It does. But anyway, as far as the actual plants themselves, what's dangerous about it and why it is not safe and why it is not clean and why this is a bunch of hooey that they're putting out there is that it is, of course, the nuclear waste that it generates, and we still do not have an open storage facility for it. It's still Yucca Mountain not only hasn't opened, but now it's supposed to be safeguarded for 1 million years because that's how long it's going to be hot. Excuse me, I don't think humanity can, you know, look, figure out what they're going to do 10 years from now, much less than a million years. We're not really good at
well,
planning.
Yeah, I mean, we think of urban society have only been around for 8,000 years. Yeah, so yeah, this is pretty dangerous. But so who's behind all this?
It's GE, for one, because they're the ones that are selling the reactors for, you know, $1 billion or $2 or $3, and that's another reason we're moving into India. Bechtel's another one, because they assemble them only occasionally backwards.
Wait, tell me, why I don't get the GE-India connection?
GE's all over India because they're trying to sell them nuclear reactors.
Oh, not for the U.S., but for, you know, in yeah, all right.
But also they're trying to sell them in the U.S. as well. GE is very much a big promoter of this, of the resurgence of nuclear energy. Bechtel benefits greatly from it because they get a call to construct them and take them down. There's a French company actually called Areva that has moved in, jockeyed its, for position and really been very successful in the U.S. That is also doing all kinds of more breeder reactor, different sorts of reactors, and they're part of, have you heard of this global nuclear energy partnership idea?
No. Tell us.
This is one of the things that the Bush administration is promoting as an alternative energy, you know, safe, clean, green idea. This is, again, hooey. What it involves is that the United States, Russia, Japan, maybe India, would be involved in collecting all the world's nuclear waste. And this is part of this grand promotion. You know, the Bush administration is hoping that we have 300 new nuclear plants up in the next couple of decades. We already have 104. Many of them are old and should be shut down. But anyway, it's part of this GNEP, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, a lot of this nuclear waste would go to Russia. Now, if you've been looking at Russia lately, the mob is all over it. They're controlling, you know, at least half, if not 60% of the banks. I personally do not want to see nuclear waste going into the hands of Russia. And I think this is just a ridiculous idea, and I get into that in the book as well. You know, where nuclear waste is being stored right now is, I find, alarming. It's in the cooling pools of many of the plant.
Right, that's right. For me, too, in Monroe, Michigan, just about 35, 40 miles south of Detroit, it's all there's just they have nowhere to put it. So then under this plan, they would ship it to Russia? Ooh, that doesn't sound like a good idea at all.
Yeah, and if we continue at the rate we're going, and if the Bush administration gets its wish of having 300 new nuclear plants, we would need 900 Yucca Mountains. I mean, we can't get one open. So the thing is, you know, I'm not here to say, you know, no nukes is good nukes. You know, we have 104. I think we don't need any more, and we should shut some of these down as they're getting older. The thing is, you know, this is not alternative energy. This is not clean. This is not green. It's not safe. This is another case where the people that were donating heavily to the Bush-Cheney reelection and, you know, the first campaign got their wishes. These were the energy people moved right in.
Melissa Rossi, I'm getting too much out of this. All of a sudden, I look at the clock. We got about 2 minutes left. The subtitle of your book, What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running America Is and What You Can Do About It. Well, more than voting, more than just every 4 years passively troop off to the voting booth, at least 50% of us do.
Go
ahead.
I think you should actively lobby on the local level. Get involved. For instance, with your utilities, go to their meetings. You know, a lot of these companies have to have public meetings. You know, get in there. Join groups. Like, and I don't care. Pick your group. If it's public citizen, common cause. If you feel strongly about Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform, but join a group and get involved and make your voice more known there. Again, some of your car choices, you can have an impact there. Watch what's going on. You know, realize what's behind the scenes is, you know, when we're going into India, what's really, you know, what are these foreign policy and trade moves about? You know, I think be more skeptical. You know, I list more things that you can do there as well. But, you know, the first step is to be aware. And I think the second step is make some noise and do it effectively. Talk radio is a great way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually be aware and get involved. Those four words ought to do it. And you have no capacity to affect anything if you continue as just an isolated, atomized individual who watches it all on television. This is the society, the spectacle. They want us just to watch. They don't want us to be a player. They don't want this really to be democratic. But the real changes that have made this country democracy to the extent that it has been over the last couple of hundred years has been all of us deciding, telling the elites, we ain't doing it like this anymore. We're going to start doing it like this. We can do it again. So to be aware, to begin with, I highly recommend this book because not only is it just filled with information, but the format is just really easy to look at, and it's written with great wit, I must say. I enjoyed reading it. The book is What Every American Should Know About Who's Really Running America and What You Can Do About It. My guest has been Melissa Rossi, and you can go to her website, whateveryamericanshouldknow.com. You can see her other books there as well. You can go to peterwerby.com as well. And we've been talking with Melissa Rossi in Thailand. And so what? It's like 3:30 in the morning the next day, right?
Correct. I'm a night owl, so I'm always up at this time listening to the Jungle Symphonies.
I can't get my mind around you're in tomorrow. Okay. Well, listen, you said you got another book coming out?
Yeah, now I'm going to the Middle East, so it's going to be about the Middle East. This is going to be very interesting. I would really love to call you from, you know, whether it's Syria or Oman or something like that. I'd love to check in and tell you how it's going. You're interested.
Am I interested? You bet. Melissa Rossi, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4. With a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica. With a big unit. Every weekday night at 10. Exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah. Yes. We're ready to go on the air from one end of the camp to the other.